questions. I need to walk around a little bit so I don't take the microphone. I think my voice is strong enough for that. And what we will do today and tomorrow is just that I will give you an introduction into high-performance computing. Today we would like to have a look at the architectural aspects about how the machines are constructed and things like that. And we will cover the topic of programming in general, so the question, what does it mean to write a parallel program? And then tomorrow we will go into details and see what libraries are available, how you do the parallel program in detail, and things like that. So the plan is that it will be in four lectures. First on architecture, second on parallel programming, just general aspects that will be covered this morning. And the second two, message passing and advanced topics of message passing, will be covered then tomorrow morning. So for the architecture, we will have several points of interest. And first, of course, the question is, why should we use high-performance computing? So what is that in general? We have to see what the meaning is, how much performance we can get from these machines. And then I will tell you a little bit about the application fields. So where do we apply high-performance computing? In which fields of science, for example? There are different things to be mentioned. And then, of course, obviously, we will use it in bioinformatics. And I will give some details, just general remarks on this. And then tomorrow we will have the talk of Alexandros Stamatakis, who will make a talk on phylogeny and combine phylogeny with high-performance computing. After that, we have to speak a little bit about the architecture of such machines. Of course, for scientists, who are not computer scientists, they say, why should I learn about the architecture? I want to get a solution for my, for example, biological program. I'm not interested in your computer science architecture. Well, the problem is that the architecture has an influence on the style of programming. So therefore, it's necessary to know at least the two classical categories of architectures that we find with high-performance computing, and to understand why we have this or that option for writing our parallel program. Then we will cover, just in short, some technical details, just a few slides to tell you something about the network and the storage. We will not go into details with this, of course, because that is pure computer science. One thing that is of interest is the list of the 500 most powerful computers in the world. I would like to present this to you because it's important to see what is now the number one, for example, how powerful the machine is, what computational capacity it has, and also how much it costs. And what is now getting more and more of a problem is also the question how much energy it consumes. So high-performance computing comes more or less to a crisis with respect to energy consumption. And I could give several talks on this because I'm currently going into this field. And we will see on the slides that for maybe 20 years, there was a permanent increase in computational power without any limits. And it seems now that we come maybe to some limits that are caused by the question how to get enough energy to our compute centers. And then we will just speak about some two, three selected systems just to give you an impression what the computer scientists do there. So why should we use high-performance computing? In fact, it is the case that we use this to replace physical experiments by computer simulation. And this is not 100% precise. What we in fact do is that we say we have three pillars on which we put our scientific knowledge, gaining of scientific knowledge. One is theory and one is experiment. And in the middle we have numerical simulation with high-performance computers. So we use this numerical simulation part to make a connection to the theory, to model and to analyze theoretical aspects, and then to replace experiments or to do a verification of the experiments, for example. I will give you some examples of this later. And of course, by using high-performance computing, we also improve the models that we have. For example, we have models for the climate development on our Earth, and they do simulation and then improve also the models. The question is, of course, which computational tasks will you put on such a machine?
So there are two options basically. One option is that you say, I have thousands of small jobs or millions of small jobs that I want to have computed. So you take a big machine and put it on a machine. Or you say you have one single huge job that has to be put on such a machine. Both aspects are candidates for high-performance computing, but the way we program it, of course, is then different. Why do we need it? I mean, we just need it because the computers that we have in our offices, they are not powerful enough. So when you want to have a complex calculation, tomorrow we will see the phylogeny computation, for example, then this is computationally so complex that a single computer cannot do it, and we want to have just more computers to put them together and have the aggregated power of these various computers then. The thing is called high-performance computing, HPC, that's the usual abbreviation for that, but to say the truth, I mean, it's not only about computing. In fact, we have to know something about fast and very fast networks, and then also we have to know something about storage. For example, I have a cooperation with the German Cancer Research Center in Heidelberg, and what they do is they have automated microscopes and make pictures from cells, and then put the pictures from the cells onto a hard disk and on tapes to store these pictures. And then do an automatic analysis with these cells. They knock out individual genes, and then you can see what goes on. The problem is we have about 30 million images, and we have about 30 terabyte of data. And the problem is, of course, to move the data from the microscope to the computer, from the computer to the storage system. It's then the computational part is only one aspect, okay? Transporting all this data is also difficult, and storing it is also very difficult. Let me just finish that slide.
Okay.
The improvement that we can get from high-performance computing will then be in such a range that we can say maybe factor 100 compared to a single workstation, up to a factor of several hundreds of thousands compared to a single workstation.
Okay. Зачем нужно высокопроизводительное вычисление? Ну, вот здесь было сказано, что это если у вас есть очень много-много маленьких задач, или если у вас есть одна большая такая задача, когда вы не можете на офисном компьютере ее решить. И таких задач достаточно много. Вот был пример, когда в экспериментальной работе используется микроскоп, и для хранения данных нужно порядка 30 терабайт памяти, чтобы хранить 30 миллионов изображений. Ну и, соответственно, нужны большие, быстрая сеть, чтобы эти данные перегонять с микроскопа на диски и так далее. То есть вот пример такой задачи в биологии. Сверхбольшие данные, сверхбольшие объемы памяти и так далее. Окей.
So, the question is, how will I get such a powerful computer? And there are different ways to do this. So the easiest way and the cheapest way, and we did this in the mid of the 90s, for example, it's just that you take the computers that you have in your institute, they are all connected together via internet or via Ethernet, and then you say, I run Linux on all these machines and I make a virtual parallel computer on top of them. So I use some additional software, and that is then a virtual parallel machine, and it's already possible to do this. The next solution will be that you go into a shop, here it would be El Dorado, in Germany we have appropriate shops, and you say, okay, give me 16 computers or give me 32 computers. You put them into a shelf, connect them together with some internet, so you buy a switch and cables, you connect them together, put some software onto it. Basically, you need Linux as a basic operating system and some libraries for the parallel computing. This is it already. And that's already your small parallel computer. So you have 16 times the power of a single workstation, 32 times the power. Usually, we use power of 2 factor, so 16, 32, something like that. And when you do something like this, then it's mainly a human resource problem. Because the point is, you need to have some people who do the management of the machine. It's not terribly complicated, but when you have 32 computers, you have a factor of 32 with respect to broken disks, problems with the fans, problems with memory, and such. So you will be busy all the time with replacing some hardware. It's better than to buy something expensive and to hire a person from a company who takes care of that. So here really, if we do it like this, we have, for example, in Heidelberg, one machine that has 256 computers,
And with that number of computers, for example, you have disk problems every second, every third day. So every second, every third day, you have to replace some disk in one of these computers. And it's just some task for people to take care of it. The other thing is that you buy something big. Either you do it yourself and buy 10,000 PCs, just like Google does, for example, or like Amazon does this, or eBay, they run many machines. Or you go to a vendor and say, I want to have some special hardware. And then also you get special network and special storage, which is more expensive but also more powerful. In most cases nowadays, then you have to also build a new building for this. And sometimes you also have to build a new electric power station. So with the highest compute power centers that we see today, it's usual in Germany, for example, we got in the last 5 years, 3-4 such new centers. And the one that I currently know of is the one from the German Climate Research Center. They get a new computer for 30 million euro, and they need a new building for the computer that also costs 30 million euro. So that is the range of the highest computers that we currently have. But you see that also in America, usually several dozens of millions of dollars for the computer, seven dozens of millions of dollars for the building for the computer. So how much do we have to pay in general if we go small scale? Let's say you go to El Dorado, for example, then you will pay something like 1,000 euro per node. For example, you pay 500, 600, 700 for the computer, and then a little bit for additional storage and a little bit for network. And you will end up with 1,000 per node. If you have 16 nodes, it will be 16,000 euro, for example. That would already be a very nice per computer. Medium scale, then you want something bigger, then we take a multiprocessor motherboard, for example, have a more powerful single computer, have a special high-speed network. We will not go into details with this. That is beyond the scope of this school here. Let's say 1,500 per node, because you need a card in the computer, and you need a powerful switch. And the switch also has a card so that you can connect the two things. We'll come to maybe 1,500 per node. And high-performance storage, which means RAID systems, tape systems, and things like that, would come to another 500. So you end up with 4,000 euro per node, but then it's already really powerful. And large scale is then money for the building, money for the power plant, and the costs are currently what we see between 20 and 400 million euro. So it's more in the range of 20, 30, 40, 50. This is extreme, some things that the Japanese do and some things that the Americans do. So where do we use this high-performance computing? In fact, we use it in all natural sciences and engineering sciences where you do numerical simulation. The main field of application is just numerical application. Numeric programs that you put on the computer because they are too time-consuming for a single one, and now you put them on a high-performance computer. So physics is an important thing. Computational fluid dynamics, which means, for example, wind tunnel simulation of new cars, things like that. Then also car crash simulation. That is one thing where it's really advantageous because you don't want to crash the real cars permanently, and so you can just simulate it. You can make small changes of the shape of the car, for example, and immediately see what influence it has. Well, immediately maybe it's not really true because a computation runs perhaps for one day or so. Weather forecast is an interesting point. And this is all in the field of numerical simulation, but also we see now that high-performance computing will be used with business applications. So business applications, they are of a different structure, but you see then high-performance computing, for example, for financial calculations. And then sometimes we use it for non-numerical computation. For example, IBM had a big computer for chess playing. Then for theory, we have something like theory proving that we sometimes do on parallel computers. And also we have commercial database applications. In fact, for example, what Google does is a big database application. They don't do numerical simulation on the huge clusters that they have. People say that they have something between 200,000 and 400,000 computers for running Google on that. And it's just a database application, a huge one, of course. And then, obviously, that's why you are here. All fields of bioinformatics are covered by high-performance computing. So where we have it is in genomics, proteomics, evolutionary biology, and some of the computers for example, this BlueJean environment that IBM constructed. In the beginning, when they started to construct this, by end of the 90s, they said that they will develop this machine exclusively as a special purpose computer for protein folding. Now it turns out that you can also use it for other things, and they do no longer insist on this, but basically in the beginning they said it's just for protein folding. Well, for which application can we use it? We can use it for, I would say, any application that runs perhaps between 1 day and 100,000 days on a single workstation. 100,000 days on a single workstation divided by 30, okay, if we have, let's say, 1,000 computers, that would mean 100 days. 1,000 days. 1,000 days would be 3 years. Okay. I would say that the longest running programs that we see on the in the moment on the highest performance computers, usually that's climate modeling, for example, they have the applications running for something like 3 months, maybe. So 3 months on a very powerful computer for only one single computation. The critical point is, and you will see this tomorrow with the phylogeny, that you can easily have applications that do not last on a single computer 100,000 days, but 10 million years, 100 million years, 1,000 million years, because the mathematical complexity is so high. So, in fact, what we need is not only high-performance computing, but we need a computation, we need a combination of new mathematical models plus high-performance computing. The one cannot live without the other. So you will see this tomorrow very clearly with the phylogeny, because there we had progress in both sections. We did the parallelization and made it faster, but also we used new mathematical models and also made it faster. And the combination together worked. One of the two alone will not be sufficient. Just to remind you of this as scientists, this is just what the computer scientists use. Okay, we have these measures like mega and giga. That might be familiar to you, but now we move into the range of tera and peta and also of exa. And I will then speak about that when it comes to the power of the computers. So usually, to measure the power of a computer is very complicated, and there's no general agreement how we will do this. And so the computer scientists said, okay, we use these computers for numerical applications, so what we use as a measure is just this number of floating point operations. Floating point is just a number that has a point in it and it's a decimal number and such. So the computation of these, let's say, for example, multiplication and division, inside a processor is the operation that is the most complicated inside the processor, and that's why we use it to give a specification of the power of these processors. For example, with a single processor, you can say something that the power might be 5 gigaflops. As a general rule, you can say if you look at a notebook and the notebook runs with a speed of 2 gigahertz, then it will make presumably per cycle two operations. And then from the 2 gigahertz, you might get something like 4 gigaflops, for example. The number one supercomputer that we currently have has already one petaflop. One petaflop is 1,000 teraflop, and 1,000 teraflop is 1 million gigaflop. So it's factor, depending on how you calculate this, number one supercomputer is factor 200,000 more powerful than we see it on a regular workstation or on a regular notebook. We don't see that strong difference for the network. So we have for the network 100 megabit and 1,000 megabit between our computers, notebooks, and so on. And for the supercomputer networks, so 1,000 is already 1 gigabit. For the supercomputer networks, we have something like 1 gigabit. 4 gigabit is a usual performance that we see. 10 gigabit is a little bit in the future. And then further in the future will be 40 gigabit per second. But just for your information. So if you compare this, then for example, with respect to main memory, you will see on a personal computer something like 2 gigabyte, for example, and on the high-performance supercomputer something like several dozens of terabyte. So 1 terabyte is 1,000 gigabyte, which means several thousands of gigabyte main memory. As disk space, we have on a single computer, for example,
something like 1,000 gigabyte. These are the biggest hard drives that you can buy, we can buy as private persons. And then you see for supercomputers, they have petabytes of disk space. So usually they do not only have thousands and thousands of processors, but they also have thousands and thousands of disk drives. Tape storage for personal computer may be something like 400 gigabyte, and for the supercomputers in the range of petabyte. The biologists in Heidelberg, for example, they are completely crazy with these microscopes because they buy more and more of these microscopes, and the microscopes get faster and faster and produce more and more data. And then they come to us, to the computer scientists, and say, now we have these nice microscopes, please take care that we can save the data that comes from these pictures. And it is really not easy at all, because just to transport the data and store it somewhere, we don't even speak of computation, okay? Just to transport it and store it is a big problem. There's this joke in America that when you want to transfer, let's say, from the East Coast to the West Coast in America, data of such microscopes, you would think that maybe you'd use the internet for that, or a fast internet connection. But we can tell you that it is quicker and has more performance to write the data to disk, put the disk onto a transporter, so FedEx, for example, or UPS, have the driver drive through America and install the disk on the other side. That has a better performance than just transporting the data via a thin cable. And I mean, this cannot be a solution for the future.
Maybe just translate. Потоки данных настолько большие, что на самом деле вот в результате этого эксперимента с микроскопом получается 30 терабайт данных. Быстрее будет взять диск, переписать на него данные, заказать быструю почту, и на машине с восточного берега на западный берег США он перевезет на машине быстрее и поставит на тот компьютер, на второй, чем это все делать через сеть. То есть насколько большие огромные данные. То есть проблема не только не просто эти данные обработать, а хотя бы их сохранить. Вот это действительно суперкомпьютерные проблемы. Окей. Nice example.
Produced by the bioinformatics people, by the way, in particular by these. Yeah, this is just one big application field, and they produce lots of data. Climate people do the same. It works a little bit different then. So let's speak about this parallelism. I mean, the point is, we spoke about one computer. We said that the power is not enough, so we will have many computers. We will use them somehow in parallel, and the question is, how will we do this? And parallelism is something that is already available inside the computers, of course, because when you have a microprocessor, and then you have the label on it that says 8-bit, 16-bit, 32-bit. Well, now we have processors, the so-called 64-bit processors. That means that you have 64-bit inside that get computed in parallel. Each number is represented by 64-bit. Did I say by bit? By 64-bit. And then already 64 things happen in parallel. So there is already parallelism inside the processor. And also, for example, inside the processor, we have special units for doing arithmetic, for doing logical operations. And we do not have these units only once. So there's not only one instance of these units, but maybe four. So you can do something like four arithmetic operations in parallel at the same time. Then, if this is not enough, what one processor gives to you, then you use more processors, or you say, I use, in addition to the processor, this is now a new trend in computer science, that people say, we use in addition the graphic card, because the graphics card also has a lot of computational power, and we run some of the computation on the graphics card. And then if this is not enough, you put together many computers. That's just what Google does. And if this is even not enough, then you say, okay, let's put together even big parallel computers or cluster computers. So you might have heard of this technical term grid computing. With grid computing, what we do is we just connect compute centers, for example, all over Europe, and get the aggregated power of all these computers into one single application. Well, in fact, it doesn't work so well, but it's a big trend. People are doing research in that field. Computer scientists do research in this field. Let's speak about the architecture a little bit. It's important to understand the architecture because it has an influence on the way we do the programming. So basically, we distinguish two classes of parallel concepts.
of concepts for parallel computers, better to say, and we distinguish it with respect to the memory organization. And we have something that is called distributed memory and shared memory. The systems that we want to distinguish are just big supercomputers that have a special construction, and cluster systems where you just put one, where you have a single component and you have 1,000 of these identical components and put them together. So this is the graphic that shows how the distributed memory concept works. What we have is the green box is just one computer, just a regular computer like our notebooks or the PC that you have on your desk, for example. So the green box is just one computer. It has one processor. Some of them might have two processors, perhaps. It's a more expensive machine. And the new models have inside one processor several so-called cores. So even my notebook, for example, is a dual-core environment. In fact, it means then, we will see it on the next slide, it means that we get a mixture of these two types of distributed memory and shared memory, which is not so good for us because with the programming it's more complicated. But just imagine you have a regular computer, so just one memory and one processor, this is it. And then you have this green box here several times, so 2 times, 2,000 times, 2,000,000 times, as you like. And the question is, of course, when you run a program on that, let's say the program runs on all these processors, or in fact it runs on all these machines, then somehow you have you have to divide the program in a way that it can run on these individual machines, and then sometimes they will have to communicate. That is what we will learn in the next lecture and also tomorrow. And the communication is then just done with so-called send and receive operations. So when a process running here says, I need to have some data that was computed, but this one says, I need to have some data that was computed here, then this one sends the data over the network to this machine. The problem is, the programmer must take care of this by himself and must do the programming correctly such that it works. So advantages are of this concept that it has a good scalability. For example, you don't have much money in the beginning. You buy 100 computers, put them together. Then you get more money and you buy another 100 or another 500. So this is very scalable. You can just put together more and more computers and extend the system whenever you have money left, so to say. The disadvantage is that this is more complicated with programming. That is what we will learn tomorrow. The problem is, it's not so easy with the programming, but it's standard. Whenever you want to have a parallel program, you just will have to learn how this works, because there's no such thing like automatic support. We will see that later then. The second architectural concept is that we have shared memory. So you have one box, you have inside the box two processors, as an example, and you have inside the box, don't care about that, you have this network, which is usually the bus system in the computer, and you have one single memory in this computer. And then the complete program and all the data that you want to compute is located here, and there's some job running on this processor, some other job running here, and when they do need to coordinate and exchange information, then just one writes data here and the other one can read it, or one writes data here and the other one can read it immediately. So there's no need for send and receive operations. And it seems in the first moment, of course, that this is an architecture that is more easy to program. But it is only from the distance. If you get closer to this programming, then you see that's also complicated. And what we have now is we have this new architecture of the processors, that we have dual-core processors or quad-core processors. And what it means is that you have one single chip that is inside your computer, but on the single chip, when it's a quad-core architecture, for example, on the single chip you have four small processors. So in fact, even with my notebook here, this is a dual-core processor, for example, in fact, this is already a small high-performance computer, so to say, and in fact, it uses parallelism. So you run the jobs on these individual cores. And by the way, if you have such a machine, then you might have seen that it doesn't work so perfectly. For example, I bought my notebook. It is a dual-core environment, but the regular applications that you run on such a notebook, like Windows and for example, when you rip some compact disk to get the music, make MP3 files, these programs are not parallel programs. So what happens is you have a notebook with a dual-core architecture. You run a compact disk music ripper to make MP3 files, and it can use only one of the two cores. So you sit in front of your machine, you see that it uses only half of the processor, which is, of course, then not the full power of the machine, and you say, well, this is not the solution I wanted to buy because I paid, let's say, 1,000 euro for the notebook, and then I want, of course, to get the full power. But with this dual-core environment, it's complicated. The producers like Intel and AMD, they have discovered this new concept of multi-core environments, multi-core processors, because it's easier then to handle the problem with the energy, to handle the power consumption of the processors. They found that when you make several cores, then you can better distribute that on the chip, and the overall power consumption is better than with one single high-performance processor. The unfortunate aspect of it is that we now have these dual-core machines and quad-core machines, and we say, okay, it's a problem, but we will perhaps be able to handle this. But meanwhile, the companies work on multi-core processors that will have 64 cores or even 1,024 cores. And I mean, imagine you have in your notebook such a processor that has 1,024 cores, then you can only use it efficiently when you have at the same time 1,024 different tasks. But I mean, usually I do email and maybe some listening to music or so, which is two tasks, okay, not 1,024. So this will really be a problem for all of our computers. The computers will then, in future, just notebooks and things like this, will then be more appropriate for you as researchers, because you can use the parallel programs that you program, put them on a notebook, and get a very good performance out of this. But for us as private users, this will be complete nonsense. But we are moving in this direction because the producers like Intel and AMD say, well, that's the only way to produce processors in the future, so we will do it. And it always works like this. The producers say, that's the way it's easy how to construct it, so you are the customer, here's the new processor architecture, then see how you get it programmed.
Just something.
With the shared memory architecture, we will not go into details with the programming of this. So the first step, perhaps I should delete this. The first step of programming is easier. But then if it comes to the point that you want to get high performance out of these environments, programming is equally complicated, and program tuning also is equally complicated as with the other machines. So there's not much difference. But the point is that the scalability here is limited. And the limitation comes from the fact that we have one single interconnection network, and all the compute components up here have to go through this network to the memory. So when you have two or four, then it's okay. But if you have 64, it already gets a problem with the access to the memory, and it's impossible to have, for example, 1,024. That cannot be technically not be solved. So the extensibility then of these environments is very limited. What we will see in the future, definitely, and there's no way around this, what we will see is a combination of both principles. Because what we will have in the future is you have a single box, and the single box is one processor, so one chip, but on the one chip you will have 4, 8, or 16 small processors. So you do shared memory program on the single box, and then you will buy 1,000 of these boxes, and you do this message passing between the boxes. Unfortunately, it will be like this, so programming in future will be a little bit more complicated than it is today.
Были показаны две типичных системы, на которых основаны суперкомпьютеры. Первая – это система с так называемой разделенной памятью, когда у каждого процессора есть своя память. Они очень дешевые, и их можно быстро нарастить. Допустим, вы за маленькие деньги купили таких 20 процессоров, потом добавили еще 50, если у вас появились деньги. И ваша программа как бы этого не заметит, она просто будет передаст часть работы на другие процессоры и так далее. Проблема в том, что каждый процессор не знает, что делается во втором процессоре, в памяти второго процессора, и они должны между собой общаться. Для этого должна быть хорошая и быстрая сеть. И очень неудобно программировать. Постоянно процессоры должны посылать сообщения: я сделал то-то, пересылаю тебе данные, значит, вот. А второй должен эти данные получить и ответить на него, на этот запрос. То есть система очень экономная, но не очень удобно писать параллельные программы. И не существует единого рецепта для написания таких программ. Второй способ – это когда вы несколько процессоров делаете с общей памятью. Но здесь у вас получается быстрый доступ к этой общей памяти, и процессоры все видят одно пространство этой памяти и могут с ним одинаково работать. Но проблема в том, что вы не можете очень много процессоров поместить вот в такой чип. И максимум 64 процессора здесь получается, и они получаются очень дорогие. И на самом деле, когда у вас проблема в том, что когда задачи не требуется, вот как в обычных домашних компьютерах, вы обычно слушаете музыку, да, у вас процессор двухъядерный. На самом деле занято только одно ядро, второе простая, вот хотя бы заплатили за это денежки. Также и здесь, то есть если у вас задачи не очень большой мощности, да, то получается, что деньги чуть ли не половину вы тратите впустую. А эта система очень дорогая. В будущем, возможно, вот эволюция какая-то этих систем, но посмотрим. Окей.
By the way, I just talked to Alexei some months ago that even with these processors, there's some kind of evolution, and we will make some evolutionary theory of that. We are, as computer scientists, we are really not completely happy about what Intel and AMD are doing, because they just produce new things that are difficult to be programmed and then sell it to us, and we just have to see how to make the best out of that. So, what I said, we will have hybrid architectures, which are combinations of the two. We have then these SMP systems or multi-core systems, and combine shared memory and distributed memory. The good thing is, of course, that we will have, again, scalability according to the money that we have. The bad thing is that the programming gets complicated, because now we have to combine shared memory architecture programming with distributed memory architecture programming. And the reality is that, well, we cannot change it, because those people who manufacture the computer, they just do it like this. Let's have a look at this these categories and distinction between supercomputers and clusters. In fact, it is no longer so true as it was in 5 years ago, because now if we look at this top 500 list, the 500 most powerful computers in the world, 400 of these 500 computers are cluster environments. Cluster means you have one component and you have many thousands of these identical components then, and put them together into one big environment. And a supercomputer, as opposed to this, is a special construction. Usually they have special processors, special network that you cannot buy somewhere else and such on. These things, independent of the architecture, okay, these things are produced by companies like IBM, Hewlett-Packard, SGI, Cray, for example. They sell big supercomputers that are special machines, but also they sell clusters, where a cluster is then a rack, and you put some so-called blades into this rack, and on each blade you have maybe 16 processors or 32, and then you buy as many blades as you want to have, put them into the rack, and get a small supercomputer, or even a big one. If one rack is not enough, then you buy 16 racks, for example. So this is then this concept of cluster. This is assembled, which means put together, by either a company or we do it ourselves. And some of the clusters are so-called commodity-of-the-shelf components. Commodity-of-the-shelf components are just the things that you can buy at Eldorado. So in their shelves, you just go to the shop, you look, what do they have, buy some computers, buy some network switch, buy some cables, and put it together. And you will be able to build a computer with 1,024 machines if you want. But it takes a lot of human resource to do that. Usually, to mention this, we have on all these machines Linux as an operating system. The operating system, in fact, doesn't play much role, but the question is which software do you put on top of it to manage the cluster? You have to do some things like, for example, to detect which of the nodes are down and which are up, such that you can bring your application efficiently to the environment. And that's more easy with Linux. Microsoft is now also producing a cluster software, a cluster management software. But of course, before it was like this, when you had a parallel computer with 1,024 machines, you would not want to buy 1,024 Microsoft Windows licenses. And you don't want, definitely you don't want to install 1,024 PCs with Microsoft, okay? You would, this would last forever. Now they have some special software, and the licensing model also got changed. And I just listened at the supercomputing conference in Dresden to a nice talk of Microsoft about their new product. But I only went there because they had a very good breakfast in this special hotel where they did. So that was okay. I can tell you that the software is still somehow nonsense. And from the 500 machines in the top 500 list, I think there's one or two machines that use the Windows operating system, and all the rest uses Linux. Many of them use just standard Linux, and some other parallel computers use a special, let's say, thinner version where they just throw out things of the kernel that they don't need. So usually we can say supercomputers are, these are the very expensive ones, dozens of millions, and they are operated by the companies. So when you buy from a Japanese company, we saw this in Munich, when you buy from a Japanese company, for example, by Hitachi, from Hitachi, a Hitachi supercomputer, then you also get two Japanese that are sitting in the office close to the computer and take care of the machine. So if something is going wrong, then they come out, repair the computer, and continue. And you will have a maintenance contract for this and cost you some money, but the machine is then has a better availability. So if we put together something like a cluster, then maybe we have a factor of 10 that it's cheaper, but the money that we save with the hardware, we have to put some part of the money into just people who take care of the machine, because every now and then something doesn't work and you have to replace this. And so usually with these cluster environments, availability is a little bit lower. But the borderline now between supercomputers and clusters gets more and more unclear. So it's when you look at the top 500, it's sometimes not really so 100% clear to which category it belongs. It was clearer 5 years ago because then it was cluster on that side, supercomputer here. But now those factories who produce supercomputers also produce clusters, and that's why it's a little bit more overlapping. Scalability is one important thing that we, a notion, a technical term that we will sometimes use here during these four lectures, and the problem is there's no real good definition for this. Usually we want to say that scalability is something like extendability with respect to the efficiency of doing this. So when I have one computer and get a performance, and then I have 1,024 computers, I would like to have 1,024 times the performance of the single computer. This would be perfect scalability. Usually you get maybe 800 times the performance of a single computer. We can live with this. Sometimes you get 500 times the power of a single computer, and this is already bad scalability. So scalability means that we extend the hardware, and proportional to this extension, we also want to have an extension of the power of the hardware. If this is not the case, then we just call it low scalability. And this refers to the compute power, to the network power, to the storage. Just one comment on the network, only one slide, just that you know this. So with the shared memory system, the simplest form for the network is just a bus system that you have inside your computer. You as scientists who do not open a computer maybe just have never seen that. Whereas with distributed memory, this is just in the network. And the network usually has a star-like topology, which means we have, for example, 16 computers, we have one switch, we have 16 cables that connect the 16 computers to the single switch. This is it. And even with the highest performance computers, we frequently see this type of network. But then sometimes they have special networks, for example, which do not have this star-like topology because the density of connections is not so high. Instead, they have special graphs
where, let's say, like Torus connection or so, where they connect more computers to direct neighbors. So everything gets very complicated, and then also everything gets very expensive. We don't do this too often because of costs. Very often we just have this star topology and have gigabit Ethernet or 10 gigabit Ethernet, or let's say there are two categories. There's a Quadrix, there's a network called Quadrix, and one that is called InfiniBand, and we use these special types of network. But let me make the storage and then I'm through with that.
Okay.
So as for the background storage, just to mention this, we have usually local disks on the computer. We use them for temporary data maybe. Then we have a file, we can have a file server in the network that we use for persistent file storage to put the files there for a longer time. And then we might have something that the computer scientists call SAN, which stands for Storage Area Network. This means that we have disks and tape drives that have their own separate network. So when you use them, the network that you use to transfer the data is not the same as in the parallel computer, which gives you more power because for the program, you have your special network that the processes can communicate, and for doing I/O, you have also special networks that you can bring the data to the disk. So that is, of course, then more expensive than the one here. And then in the background, we have to have also tape systems for several petabyte of data just to permanently store the data for a longer time.
Немножко вернусь, да, что существуют две системы высокопроизводительных компьютеров. Одни из них суперкомпьютеры, это специально разработанные машины, которые фактически это собранные воедино один большой персональный компьютер, где специально разработанные процессоры, специально разработанные системы хранения памяти, доступа и так далее. А их производят только большие фирмы. Вот. А вторые это кластеры. Это фактически много-много персональных компьютеров, поставленные в ряд, что называется, и объединенные сетью. Значит, и для кластеров вы можете пойти в магазин и купить все запасные части, что называется, вот в Эльдорадо. Пойти, значит, и купить, и собрать из них кластер. Обычно это не отдельные персональные компьютеры, а ставят стойки вот такие. То есть это такие компьютеры персоналки, у которых очень много деталей выкинуто. Значит, здесь говорилось о проблемах масштабируемости. Это очень важный параметр при суперкомпьютерных вычислениях. Когда вы покупаете больше классов, больше узлов вычислительных, вы хотите, чтобы у вас, допустим, вот вы купили в 5 узлов, и хотите, чтобы ваша программа работала в 5 раз быстрее. Но, к сожалению, такое получается не всегда. Хорошая масштабируемость, когда вашей задачей, вашей программы, вашего компьютера, это когда вы действительно купили, там, допустим, 100 компьютеров, соединили их в сеть, и получили, что ваша программа работает в 100 раз быстрее. На самом деле это очень хорошая идеализация, такого не бывает. Вот. Что касается связи, обычно система операционная используется Linux, да. Что касается связи, используется для суперкомпьютеров, это, как правило, шины, для систем с общей памятью, для кластеров это что-то похожее на обычный интернет. Ну и здесь вот системы хранения, они настолько большие бывают, что для них специально строится своя сеть между дисковыми системами хранения. То есть это большие такие стойки с дисками. Для них своя система хранения данных, свое взаимодействие. Окей. Да, да, да. В смысле цены, да?
Нет, имеется в виду надежность. Я как бы системный администратор, наоборот, если мы хотим обеспечить надежность, мы одни и те же данные на разные узлы расставили. То есть узел вышел из строя, ничего страшного, данные на других узлах.
Но вы должны к этому узлу, к узлу подойти и диск поменять.
Да,
это понятно. Это система, одно отдело системы, мы говорим сейчас о железе. То есть система позволяет, да, данные сохранить вам, но тем не менее вы должны подойти, поменять там этот диск и так далее. А если у вас там, допустим, 100 компьютеров стоят, вот говорилось раньше, что если у вас 256 вот, компьютеров стоят, это означает, что если вы построите аналогичный кластер на персоналках, да, у вас будет означать, что раз в два дня у вас где-то вылетает диск. То есть вы должны специально человека на это дело, значит, содержать, чтобы он ходил только и диски вставлял и вынимал.
Да, но система будет целая.
Но система будет работать, да, но тем не менее на поддержку вы должны покупать эти диски и так далее. Суперкомпьютеры, они вам позволяют на этом экономить. То есть они позволяют экономить на вот такой рутинной работе по замену деталей машин. Все понятно, да, или еще не совсем? Окей.
So as for the operating system, as I already said, mostly Linux, some of them, Hewlett Packard also, still have, still also use their own Unix-like system, and Windows sometimes, but not so popular. One thing that sometimes appears is something that is called a single system image. When you have small clusters, let's say 16 nodes, for example, there's special software available that just hides the fact that these are several machines. So there's something like these MOSIX, let's say, software on top of the local operating system, which gives you the view that you work with one big powerful machine instead with 16 small ones. And for example, when you start a job, you want to compile a program or something like that, it just puts the job automatically onto a machine that has available resources and runs it then there efficiently. So sometimes we see things like that. I just want to mention it because this technical term here, you will find it sometimes in the literature when people speak about cluster computing. So let's have a look at this top 500 list. There is an effort that was started in 1993 or so, where some people, some Germans and Americans, sat together and said, well, we will make a list of the most powerful computers in the world. And they maintain this list for now 16 years, something like this, 15 years. And this is very interesting. So the list gets updated 2 times per year. One time, and I just come from this conference more or less, is in June on the supercomputing conference in Germany. This year it was in Dresden. And next update will be then on the supercomputing conference in the United States that also is on different places. So the question is, of course, how will we make this ranking? Based on which, we call this benchmark program, based on which program will you make this ranking? And in fact, well, there's always discussion about the correct program to do this. There's no such solution. So what they do is just, they have something that is a package for linear algebra computation, and they run some of these programs, just measure how quick they are, and compute the number of gigaflop per second that you get from a certain supercomputer. And then they compare supercomputers based on this program and on this measure. This is, of course, not completely fair, because computers that have the same computational power might be different with respect to the network and might be different with respect also to the storage. And the LINPACK benchmark has no influence on storage at all, because it doesn't do any storage, and it has not so high influence on the network, because it's mainly to check the power of the processor and processor memory interconnection. Well, so there are many arguments against this, but it's more like, I would say it's more like a gentleman's game, okay? They just want to have some measure to compare these computers, even if it's not 100% correct, to see in particular where the development goes. That's the important part of it. So what we can see if we compare two lists, and we have 6 months in between these two lists, we can see that usually half of the systems fall off the list. So 250 computers that were listed in June will not be on the list in November, presumably. And also, usually it works like this. When you have a new computer and you get on rank X, for example, we have installed in Germany a new supercomputer in Jülich, which was in November on position number 2, and it's now, I think, on position number 6 or 7 or something like that. So usually it works like this. When you are on the list, let's say on rank 2, the next time you are on rank 6, then on the next list, I would say rank 15, rank 30, rank 100, rank 200, and then you are gone. After 3 years or so, you are gone from the list. And I will show you the tendency later on some on the charts that we get here. So this is the list of the first 10 computers that we see on the current list. So we have here at this Los Alamos National Laboratory in the United States. So Los Alamos National Laboratory They just recently installed a new computer with a name you can read here. Well, the name, you know, the name is Roadrunner. Do you remember this comic thing, Roadrunner, Meet Me, Running Through the Desert, by Walt Disney? Or, no, by, that was such a cartoon film. Maybe it was not Walt Disney, one of the others. So, the film company phoned us, gave us a phone call on the day before the list was presented in Dresden, and said that the name Roadrunner is protected by copyright for just this film company. And we are not allowed to mention this name for the computer during the conference. Otherwise, they will send us their lawyers and will make a lot of trouble. So, I mean, that was completely stupid. And this colleague of mine who organizes this big conference just said in his opening ceremony that he already in the morning had a phone call with his lawyer and asked whether it will be correct or not to mention this name. So Roadrunner, I mean, Roadrunner is a just normal English word. It's just this strange word that can run so quickly. And there is no way to copyright that somehow. But, well, okay. That's the nonsense behind all this copyright protection and everything. Okay, the machine is called Roadrunner. It's a new one. It's recently installed. And it has now broken this the petaflop barrier. We see here that we have a performance, a measured performance of 1,026 teraflop, which is just one petaflop. And this is what we measure, and the value here is just what we calculate from the documents from the producer. So you see the theoretical maximum performance would be something like 1,375 teraflop, but you will not get this out of the machine with a regular program, in particular not with a SplintPak. And well, so this is number one here, and it has 122,000 processors. And the machine is really strange because what they use is they have something like, I don't know, 60,000 AMD processors or AMD cores, and then they have this cell processor and also have many cell processors in there. So, to say the truth, it's a mixture of two types of processors, and I'm just curious to see how they want to program that in the future. Because the machine is completely new, they just ran the LINPACK benchmark, they got the value, and now this will be given to the scientists, and the scientists will say, cell processor? No idea how to program that. And we will see in the next year what will happen. What's new on the list now, just from this list, is that they also give the power consumption. So this here is 2,000, well, it's the 2.3 megawatt. And this is what we see with the new high-performance computers. That is really the problem. You see here values that are in the megawatt range already. And when you have a computer that uses, in this case, 2.3 megawatt, for example, this is only the computer. The computer produces heat. And to get rid of the heat, you need another, usually 2.3 megawatt approximately, to cool it, and also for the disks and all that. So you will end up with a power consumption by such an environment of, let's say, 5 megawatt. And 5 megawatt power consumption in Germany, for example, will cost you per year 7 million euro just for electricity. And this is absolutely crazy, because the computer might cost something like 50 million, maybe, and you spend 7 million per year just for electricity, and then you run it for 5 years, it costs you 35 million euro. And by the way, this is not only true for these huge machines, that's also true for small PCs. In Germany, when you calculate the electricity that a regular PC takes, if you run it 24 hours a day, then within 5 years, it will cost you so much with electricity than the computer itself costed. And the difference is, it's getting worse and worse, because electricity is getting more and more expensive and hardware is getting more and more cheap. So there's already this joke that the atomic nuclear power producers say, well, I will give you the compute center, 30 million for example, for free, but you buy 5 years my electricity. Just like with the ink printers, okay? The ink printer itself is just nothing,
But the ink that you need for refill, that's the expensive thing. And we are now in this situation with the computers and the electricity already. So here you see our nice computer now on rank 6 in Jülich, which is a blue gene environment, 65,000 processors. And this one is really, I will speak about this later, this one is really power efficient. So with 65,000 processors, we only have half a megawatt power consumption. This one is the most impressive. That was the leader from the last list, the biggest machine that we have now in the world with almost 220,000 processors, PowerPC processors, and that's really a huge one. When I was here 2 years ago, we had only one entry for Russia in June 2006. That is the slide from June 2006, which was a good start. And I don't know exactly, I think it's installed in Moscow, 1,000 processors. And you can have with this top 500 list, it gives you on the website many options, so you can automatically generate sub-lists and things like that. So when you produce a sub-list for Russia today, 2 years later, then you see that there are 9 entries of Russian supercomputers in that list. One, the one here, that's also one that I know of, that is located in Tomsk. Well, next time they will no longer be on the list, that's almost for sure, I would say. But you see number 36, 5,000 processors in the Moscow State University, and quite some computational power available. Also here you see that this is almost place 500 and has a value of 9 teraflop. And 9 teraflop is, so to say, the entry level for the top 500 list. So the rank 500 has something like 9 teraflop. And the level 1 has 1,000 teraflop. So this is the development over the years, and this is really interesting. So just please remark that on the y-axis, we have something that is a logarithmic scale to the base of 10. And here we have the time, so they started in 93 with this, with collecting the data. And what you see here is the red line is rank number 1. The pink line here, the violet line here is rank 500. And the green line here is the aggregated power of all the 500 computers on the list. So what is impressive and astonishing, and nobody would have expected that before, is the fact that the green one and the pink one here, that they are completely linear. So that was really not to be expected. I mean, they are linear on a Y scaling that is logarithmic. Imagine that. So what happens is, for example, that if we take something like a computer that was place 500 here, 1 gigaflop, and let's say factor, it fell off the list in the middle of 94, so 1 gigaflop was no longer on the list at that date. And if we take, let's say 1 teraflop, how to compute that? Let's see. Okay, I must take another example. So, okay, what I want to say with the example, I just have to select some other points. What I want to say is that we can see on this drawing here, on this development, that we have a factor of 1,000 increase of computational power every 11 years. So we have here, for example, 1 teraflop. Why is the 1 teraflop here? As an aggregated power in 93, and we should see 1 petaflop as an aggregated power in 2004. So that's, of course, the aggregated power, but you can also see it here. You have the 1 gigaflop, you have the 1 gigaflop in 94, for place 500, and you have the 1 teraflop for place 500 in the middle of 2004. So approximately every 11 years, you have an increase of power of factor 1,000. By the way, not only for supercomputers, but also for notebooks and PCs. For rank 1, of course, we have the thing that has here these steps. This is a machine, I just tell you, a Japanese product, the Earth Simulator, that was on rank 1 for several years. You see, there was a big jump in the year where it came to the list. So from something like 7 teraflop that the Americans had at the time to something like
35 teraflop that the Japanese computer then had. This here is the BlueJean machine, then they got the BlueJean extended, and this is this new petaflop thing. So when you draw a line, for example, here at the 1 gigaflop level, see, 1 gigaflop, for example, would have been on the top 500 list until 1994. And 1 gigaflop is approximately the power of my notebook. So my notebook would have been in the top 500 list if it had existed at that time until 94, approximately. And it's absolutely sure that within 11 years, I mean, we should write some note and take it out in 11 years, it's absolutely sure that in 11 years you will have notebooks that have 1 teraflop of computational power, and that the notebook of the year 2019 will be in this range here, on this level, and would have been a supercomputer in the year 1997, for example. And this will definitely happen because of the fact that they have these multi-core environments and they push that forward. It's unbelievable. I mean, these graphical processors that you have on graphics card already now have dozens and sometimes 100 of gigaflop on one single processor. And within 11 years, they will be able to miniaturize that enough that you just put it into one notebook. The development, as these are straight lines, more or less, on this logarithmic scale, the development can be projected to the future. That's what we do. So we assume that we have seen the 1 petaflop machine here in 2008, and we expect to have then 10 petaflop, 100 petaflop, and one so-called exaflop 11 years later. But I would assume that maybe there's a chance that it will make a curve and not follow the straight line because of the energy problem. Because with the energy, it's really getting problematic. Now we have, let's say, 5 megawatts being delivered to a compute center. And in Germany, the electricity companies say, well, 5 megawatts, that's already a lot. Maybe we can give you 10 or 20, but then this is already the border. So the Japanese have some data centers that get 140 megawatt, 2 times 70 megawatt, into one single compute center, but you need almost an atomic reactor for that. Yeah? So the regular German atomic reactor has 1,000 megawatt, and if you run a compute center that uses 140 of 1,000, this is then a lot. Yeah? I mean, it's getting completely crazy with that. Perhaps here.
Здесь вот показаны графики роста вычислительной мощности, но главная проблема, то есть они практически линейные. Вот нижний график — это самый слабенький компьютер, а верхний — самый, значит, вот красный график — это самый мощный компьютер, а зеленый график — это суммарная мощность, если мы посчитаем все вместе суперкомпьютеров. Видно, что за 11 лет в 1000 раз увеличивается мощность. Ну и в теории предполагается, что, ну, скорее всего, так оно и будет, что скоро у нас ноутбуки будут иметь терафлопную вот где-то вот мощность вычисления. Как правило, сейчас это происходит на графических картах, стоят многопроцессорные системы, то есть фактически все идет к тому, что мы будем в ноутбуках иметь суперкомпьютеры, именно основанные на параллельных вычислениях, на процессорах с параллельными ядрами. Проблема в том, что увеличение мощности требует увеличения энергии. И фактически сейчас мощность, потребляемая центрами обработки данных, основанных на таких суперкомпьютерах, требует мощности, сравнимой с производством на одной атомной электростанции. То есть фактически это есть некий физический предел, который, скорее всего, будет приводить к тому, что этот наклон будет немножко более пологий, то есть выйдет на какую-то пологий уровень. Окей?
Okay? Just recently I calculated one example because I wanted to have some data for a talk. So when you run, for example, a climate simulation on a regular German supercomputer that has, on a smaller one, that has 1 megabyte of, that uses 1 megabyte of power, if you run the climate simulation for 1 month, this will cost you 150,000 euro just for electricity. So it would be nice if the programming was correct and the result is also correct. Because if you have to run the program for a second time, then might be that the ministry will come and say, well, guy,
what about the money that I gave to you? You spend everything for electricity.
And by the way, the ministry only, I mean in Germany and I would say worldwide, they only now learn that it is not enough to give to a university 30 million euro for a computer. Instead, over the next 5 years, they will need another 30 million just for electricity. And the problem, for example, in Germany is just the budgeting concept. So they have budgets for buying something, and they have budgets for operating something. These are different things. So operation sometimes has to be paid by the university. And they are really shocked by the electricity bills that they get now. And it's getting worse and worse. So one computer that I wanted to mention is just this Earth simulator, because it was one jump forward at the time it was installed in the late 90s from NEC that has so-called vector processors, special type of processors, altogether 5,000 processors. At the time that was a lot. And they spent 200 million for the computer. It's some years ago, so you know, producing such a big computer was very complicated, and the technology was not so far that they put many components together. That's why it's so unproportionally expensive. And also they needed a power station for that, which also costed another 200 million. And what they do is climate research. Well, I have many friends that do climate research, and I always tell them, you should try to somehow predict the climate change, not to produce it, just by having these extremely power-consuming compute centers. Yeah? They produce more heat and contribute to the climate change than they do with the calculation than detect. It's really strange. So some data of the machine that was really impressive at the time, for example, the terabyte of main memory, then 80,000 copper cables, 2,000 kilometers of cable in that machine, and the size of 3,000 square meter. Japanese building, which means, of course, they need to have an earthquake protection, and the machine used 7 megawatt. At the time when it was installed, it had then the performance of 35 teraflops, something like this. The most powerful American machine had something like 5-7 teraflop, and so that's why the Americans were completely shocked. And call this thing the Sputnik shock. I mean, they had one shock before, that was the Sputnik shock. And when the Russians went to outer space at first, not the Americans, and now they had the Japanese building such an extremely powerful supercomputer, and also passing the Americans by a factor of 5 or something like that. And they worked hard on getting ranked number 1 back then on the list. NEC, by the way, is already planning a new big machine, but that is currently under construction, I think. So this is the drawing of this building. You see, for example, we have several levels. On this level, you have all these racks. In the middle, you have the network. The yellow ones are the racks with the processors and computers, and the gray-blue ones here are the ones for storage. Then you have one intermediate level where you have all the cabling, and then you have down here the climate. Everything is in one special building that is flexibly installed just for earthquake protection. Here you have one Japanese standing around. You see just a comparison of the size of the thing. 3,000 square meters. They usually don't show you this picture of the power plant because, well, it was just necessary. I'm not so proud of this. So it was clear at the time that we now had, by the end of the 90s, a supercomputer with 35 teraflop of computational performance. And just some years before that, we broke the 1 teraflop barrier. So we had now at this time 35. And everybody, of course, spoke of having 1 petaflop. Now we achieved this 1 petaflop just recently, this June. But at the time with the Earth simulator, one thing was clear. You cannot have 1 petaflop just by clustering something like Earth simulators. For example, it has 35 teraflop. You could say, okay, let's construct 30 of these buildings, 30 power plants, that will give us 1 petaflop. Well, I mean, in theory, yes, but in practice, that would be much too expensive. So the Americans, in particular IBM, they came up with a concept where they said we must have a higher integration, put together more processors on a smaller space, and try to make it more power efficient also. And then what they did is they developed something that was called Blue Gene, and they projected that they want to have a Blue Gene environment of 180 teraflop by the end of 2004. That was the projection, so we had it, I think, in 2005 or something like that. And then they want to double this just by putting more processors. They projected that they will have one petaflop in 2007. Now, okay, it's 2008. Was quite okay. And of course, they project that they want to have three petaflop in 2008, and it will now be 2009 maybe or so. The machine was constructed in a way that they said, okay, let's take one processor, put several of them on a chip, put several of these chips onto a board, from the boards make one such rack, one such tower, and then put several towers together and make one big environment. What they did really was, in the beginning, that they said, we give it not so much memory, we will use something like 0.5 gigabyte per core of the processors, which is not much, because usually when you have a general purpose parallel computer, you must have something like maybe 4 gigabyte or 16 gigabyte per processor. Computational, let's say climate simulation, for example, is extremely memory intensive because they have lots of data. They put a grid over the globe. They have a distance of grid points of, let's say, 100 kilometers or something like that, or 10 kilometers, and then they compute the climate. And this is an extreme amount of data, so they need a lot of main memory. So IBM said, well, main memory also needs a lot of electricity, of course. IBM said, well, we will lose less memory because with the machine, we will mainly do things like protein folding. Protein folding is not so memory demanding because you have then just in the memory the data for the protein, and then you have to see how it folds. And this is extremely computational intensive, but not so memory intensive. So it was obvious that you can use this machine for things like bioinformatic applications, for example, in particular this protein folding. But the climate research people said, well, we cannot use that machine because our codes will not run on the machine, which I think is true. They try to at the moment. The question is still not 100% solved. So in fact, what we see here is an environment that is better with respect to power consumption. So you will have one petaflop of computational power with only 3 megawatt of power input maybe, but it's not a 100% general purpose supercomputer. There will be applications that will not be able to run perfectly on this environment. Other ones like bioinformatic will. Okay.
Okay. Вот были представлены два. Два примера суперкомпьютеров. Один из них это Earth Simulator, это переводится как компьютер, который моделирует поведение Земли, построенный японцами, и он впервые преодолел 30, это был большой рывок в компьютеростроении, что называется, но когда он был построен, был недавно, до этого недавно преодолен терафлопный барьер. И значит, все начали говорить о том, как преодолеть петафлопный барьер, то есть сделать еще в 1000 раз мощнее компьютеры. Казалось бы, взять и поставить таких 30 штук, да, как японский компьютер. Но это не совсем так, потому что это совершенно экономически невыгодно и невозможно. Поэтому стали думать, как к этому делу подобраться. И вот один из примеров – это BlueGene, который основан на процессоре PowerMac Macintosh. Их помещают вот такими пачками на одну плату. Эти платы помещают в ящики. Фактически это очень дешевая система получается, но у нее один недостаток. У нее процессор может обращаться к памяти только 1 гигабайт. Ну, сейчас 1 гигабайт даже на ноутбуках стоят тупо 4 гигабайта памяти. То есть задачи, которые требуют для вычисления много памяти, на таких суперкомпьютерах решать нельзя. То есть он очень быстрый, требует очень мало памяти, потому что там низкопотребляющие компьютеры, процессоры, но тем не менее моделировать климат на такие задачи нельзя. Вот он был построен под задачей моделирования типа укладки белка, где памяти как бы не нужно, а нужно только перелопачивать, что называется, числа. Он очень хорошо вычисляет, но если вам нужна большую память для данных, локальную на процессоре, то здесь это не сработает. То есть компьютер мощный, но не все задачи на нем можно решать. И так, в общем-то, оно и получается, что есть вот для каждого суперкомпьютера своя специфика программирования, своя специфика разработки алгоритмов. Окей.
So this brings us already to the end of this first part. And to summarize, what we've seen here is just what the architecture principles of these supercomputers are. So we've seen that the factor of increase of computational power that we can get from these environments, there will be something, depending on the machine that you have, will be something in the range of 100 to maybe 200,000. So if you need more, then I can tell you it's just not available today. There will be 1,000 factor more in 11 years, so we can just lean back and wait for 11 years and say, well, we stop our research at the moment. Because we know that we will have more powerful computers in the future. The development will go on, and it will be interesting to see, in my opinion, whether in the future it will still be based on silicon. Because the physicists, for example, they announced that the silicon era is more or less dead. They say another 5 years or 10 years, then we will have something different, for example, nanotubes and things like that, or quantum computer, or maybe something like biological cells that compute things. So there are many developments going on, and it's not clear what will be the architecture type of the computer in 2050, for example. Just remember that the transistor and the chips are not so old, it's just some decades, okay, and there will of course be changes in the future. Application fields for supercomputers are everywhere where you need to do a lot of computation that has to be performed, numerical computation in particular. When we want to distinguish different computers, then usually we do it with the memory organization. We say we have shared memory architecture and we have distributed memory architecture. Unfortunately, by having these multi-core processors, we have it now always in a mixed form. Because in future, already now, but in future also, the single computer will already be something like a small shared memory supercomputer, because it will have several cores. 2 is already now standard, and 4 is coming up, and 8 will be in the next year, and things like that. And from these processors, we put together several, and then we have a mixture of shared memory environment and distributed memory environment, which doesn't make the programming particularly easy, which we will see in the next slides then. Distributed memory scales well, it's difficult to program. Shared memory does not scale, is easier to program, but also, well, not trivial, okay? So that has to be learned, but it's easier than with detection of errors, for example. The most widespread concept is just this cluster architecture, where we say we have identical components, just like a processor and a storage and some main memory, and from these components we have 100,000 copies and put them together to one big environment. And the number one supercomputer that has processors of two types, let's say these AMD regular processors and the Cell processor, which is a special purpose processor, that is the one of the Sony PlayStation. They put these things together and get a lot of computational power out of the machine. Programmability, okay, we will see. Might be, it will be so-so. And we now cross the 1 petaflop borderline, which is 1,000 teraflop, and we expect to cross the 1 million teraflop borderline in another 11 years, if we will be able to get enough electricity for the computers, or if we will be able to miniaturize them in a way that they don't consume so much energy. And I mean, there's also progress with energy consumption, so we work on that. And we will see new concepts in hardware also in the future. Okay, thanks for the attention for this first part.
Okay, any questions? Yeah. Okay, one question.
What do you think is the upper limit for CMPC for computational power if you take into account quantum effects, for instance, the minimization of the chip?
Okay.
Not a reasonable
computational power, but just the physical.
The first part of the question was easy, but then you had the second part where you said the quantum effects. By the way, just when I start from the back, from the question, just I wondered, for example, what will be the minimum energy that you need for one floating point operation or for one calculation? And I asked this question to some colleagues, and recently someone found that in Nature there was a paper published on that question. So I think this guy, the author, speaks about quantum effects and about the minimum energy that you need for doing a single calculation in a chip. And from this minimum energy, you can compute at least, for example, what could be energy-wise the power of a single PC. Let's say, then, just answering this question from the other side, the power of a single PC, well, I don't know. For example, on the supercomputing conference, there's a company named Psychotex. And Psychotex produces a special low-energy processor, which means low voltage, lower frequency. And they get out of a regular box, which has 200 watt, which is just like a normal PC, they get out of this machine a computational performance of something like 70 gigaflop, which is pretty good. So colleagues of mine added into a regular PC NVIDIA graphic cards, and I think the NVIDIA gives you, I don't know, maybe 100 gigaflop per card, but it uses a lot of energy. So when you have two of these cards in a regular PC, I don't know the number, maybe you will get 200 gigaflop out of the machine, but you will have to have a power supply for 1,000 watt. So I think that at the moment, a reasonable limit is somewhere, a borderline would be something like 100 gigaflop for reasonable energy in one regular PC. And then if you look forward for 5 years or so, it will steadily go up and up, and hopefully energy consumption will remain constant and will not increase proportional to computational power being delivered. So I think at the moment we are, let's say for extremely powerful PC, we are in the range of several dozens of gigaflop, and with graphic cards we will get up to 100 gigaflop maybe. But as I said, I think that with the multi-core technology that is already in the laboratories of the chip producers, and they plan chips that have 64 cores, and even the first prototype exists for 1,024 cores on a single chip, then I'm pretty convinced that you will have a computational power of 1 teraflop in a notebook in 11 years, and can handle this energy-wise.
Also from the quantum.
I don't know about the quantum effects, how they will influence that. So that is not my field of knowledge, so to say.
Okay.
Yeah, one more question. Греется. Да. Так, да, там идея такая, что на нагрев тратится энергия, а еще столько же энергии тратится на охлаждение. А как вы охладите? Не знаю. The question is, what is the why it's heating, and how to, I explained that the heating is one point, and the power consumption for to remove heating is the same for heating itself. So the power consumption I think doubles for in this manner. It's okay? Yeah.
It's okay. It's something like this. They now think about, it's not only the cooling that takes another 100%. The problem is when the power gets into the compute center, then it is alternating current. And they have this, how is that in English? Uninterruptible power supply. You know, the battery that you have to run the computer when there's a failure of power. Then there are some batteries that can continue with the computer. So alternating current comes into the compute center. They transfer it to direct current to put it into the batteries, and then they transfer it back to alternate current to run the computers. And then for the computers you have, let's say for the consumers, you have the computer, you have the cooling, and you have the storage. And storage and cooling and losses here will make 50% of the overall power consumption, and the computer makes another 50%. And now, of course, they think of trying to do something with the heat. The problem is, the heat is not really so hot. So the problem is, it's 40 degrees, it's 50 degrees. It's not easy to use that for heating of houses, for example. Because for this, it is not high enough. Yeah? The temperature of the processors is so-so. I mean, they try to do this now. For example, I'm a little bit concerned about Hamburg. In Hamburg, they have this climate research center in the very middle of the town. They get a new computer. The new compute center will have something like 1.5 megawatt. And there are living houses that surround the compute center, just regular houses where people live. And I imagine that 1.5 megawatt in the center of town is really a source of heat that will not be so pleasant for the neighbors. In winter, it might be okay. In summer, it might be a problem. Yeah? I mean, really, I don't know whether they calculated this, but I imagine that this is a problem. Okay. And well, they now try all sorts of techniques to do this more efficiently. For example, do the cooling. Let's say we have two concepts. That either you can cool with air or you can cool with cold water. But with cold water, the cooling concepts get more complicated. The cooling efficiency is better, but it's more difficult to have water running through a computer than to cool it down. But now, as they found that energy got so expensive in proportional, they do more and more research just on this. And they do something that is called green IT, you know, ecological IT concepts. We also put our foot into this area to try to work on these problems. And what we'll see in the future, I think this is a real interesting new field of research that is now opened.
Okay. Please. Хорошо.
Сказали, что вроде будут разработки принципиального процессора, разработки принципиального именно суперкомпьютера, то есть не кластер, не суперкомпьютер.
А, понятно. Ага. The question is, you told that you there is a research in developing multi-core processor now, and do such research exist for high-performance computing architecture? Something new than supercomputer and new than cluster? Some new concepts in organizing such high-performance computing?
Whether we will see this. Mm. The question is whether we will have this in future.
In future.
So the question is whether in future we will have even new concepts.
Yeah.
But so, I don't think so. I think what we see at the moment, we see two streams. One stream is that a single processor gets replaced, a single regular standard processor gets replaced by a processor with several cores. 2, 4 at the moment, 8, 16 in the near future, and many, many of them in the medium range future. So this means that this processor that is connected to its memory will, when it has several cores, already be a multi-processor shared memory environment. And you would use, you will see it on the next talk, you will use the particular programming techniques, like thread programming, for example, to just master this one here efficiently. Then, with the regular cluster concept, we will just put together several of these components. This will be standard as we did it the last 20 years. But in addition, and this is the second development stream that we see now, in addition, we will use things like special processors, like a cell processor, or special processors that are on graphic cards, these GPUs, graphic processing units. We will use additional heterogeneous hardware in addition to the regular processors. So we run the program on the regular processors. When there is something that is numerically intensive, let's say vector multiplication or something like that, we can perhaps put it onto the special hardware, which is much, much faster, and then get the results back. But of course, as this is now heterogeneous, we have regular processors here and cell or graphics cards there. This means that the programming will be more complicated. And we will see on the slides that even if everything is homogeneous and peaceful, programming is already much more complicated than on a single processor. So even if it's just a regular homogeneous parallel computer, it's much more complicated. And now when we get these heterogeneous things, the programming will definitely not be for beginners. So I mean, there must be some specialists who write the programs for the scientists, for example. Because the scientists will not be able, in my opinion, to use these architectures 100% efficiently. But maybe it's okay to use it 50% efficiently.
Окей. Пока что, видимо, новых архитектур не ожидается, поскольку есть две основных. Это когда у вас есть многоядерные процессоры, вы из них делаете кластеры. А второй способ – это когда у вас есть более-менее унифицированное какое-то ядро, да, которое вычисляет основную работу. Ну вот как графическая карта в персоналке. А часть работы, которая вычислительно интенсивная, вы сбрасываете на этот сопроцессор. Это специализированные процессоры, которые для каких-то определенных операций разработаны, как графическая карта. И эти спецпроцессоры, они у вас обрабатывают данные, затем посылают вот... То есть система примерно такого типа. Ну, в общем, в любом случае, в этом и в том, ситуация такова, что написать программы под такие системы достаточно трудно, и, скорее всего, будет специальный штат программистов, то есть сейчас ученый берет программу на C, да, пишет алгоритм какой-то, вот, в будущем это будет очень трудно учесть вот эти все взаимодействия между системами, и что будет дальше, я не знаю, то есть это, видимо, будут специальные люди, которые будут работать на ученых. Хорошо, следующий вопрос. Окей.
Yeah, we can speak about that later. It will not be covered here, because here we speak about parallelization of one big application and putting it onto a parallel machine. So what you would need is that when you have a set of many jobs, a system that puts the jobs onto the individual processors. And this is available in the form of the so-called scheduling system. So there are free solutions available, PBS, the portable batch system, that's the name, for example. PBS does things like that. And we use these batch systems for two purposes. Or in fact, we use it for one purpose. The purpose is put applications onto the nodes of the cluster. But the applications that we put onto the nodes can be of any type. So they can be non-parallelized programs where you just only need one node, or there are parallel programs where you need, for example, 16 nodes, 32 nodes. And what the batch system does is just to put onto nodes that are available the application. So in case, for example, we also do this with this picture analysis. When we have 30 million pictures or images that we have to analyze, the analysis itself is not computational intensive, needs only a few minutes, for example, makes no sense to parallelize this. Instead, the most primitive and quickest parallelization is just to say, here, 30 million jobs, here, 1,000 nodes, just do the work. And then the batch system distributes onto the nodes that are available the jobs and gets this done by the time automatically, and that works perfectly. And in this case, you will not have to change the program. You can just use your image analysis. For example, we have artificial intelligence image analysis programs. We just use them, don't parallelize them, because there is... And this is, by the way, a very frequent situation in bioinformatics, because sometimes you have, like with these pictures that we take, they knock out the individual genes. So they have cells, genes are knocked out, and they get 30,000 variations because they knock out this or that gene. From the 30,000 knocked out cells with knocked out genes, they make 100 pictures, a time series. So you get 30 million pictures. And then the parallelism is trivial. Yeah, that's a good thing. We see many of these applications in the field of computational biology, because you have a small job, but you have to run it with different input data, a And then the parallelize, you don't have to parallelize the program, you just use the cluster environment for putting jobs here and there. And sometimes this works well, and for other applications like the protein folding, for example, it doesn't work like this. So you have to parallelize the program to get better performance.
Okay. One more question. Да, вопрос был в том, что можно ли на обычной системе как-то использовать параллельные, допустим, соединив кластер и компьютер, как это можно использовать? Действительно, это можно, если это особенно легко, если у вас задача заключается в том, что вы хотите одну программку небольшую запустить на разных данных, да, вот, допустим, обработка изображения. Само одно изображение обрабатывается там, ну, одну минуту, но у вас их 30 миллионов. И, в принципе, простейший аналог такой параллельной системы – это система, когда у вас… Она запускает одну и ту же задачу с разными данными на разных процессорах. И вы, или, допустим, вот у вас вы хотите, это аналог того, что вы запустили там на одном процессоре, там вы считаете дерево филогени, на другом у вас бласта. Система сама видит, какой процессор свободный, и просто раздает задачи на разных процессорах. Это простейшая система, но не всегда такое получается. Например, вот проблема сборки белка, вы должны саму задачу распределить. То есть она у вас одна. Задача, которая требует большого числа вычислений. И вы ее на одном процессоре будете считать очень долго. Вот. Но она у вас одна. Как правило, для одного белка нужно посчитать некую оптимальную конформацию. Хорошо. Окей. Okay. I think it's enough for question. We have a coffee break. And you can, discuss this. I think we should get out of time. And we have 10 minutes coffee break.
Okay.
Okay, now we are continuing, and небольшое объявление. Сегодня, если кто не знает, в 5 часов у нас, после докладов молодых ученых, у нас будет опять семинар, продолжение. Это представит Стефан Хайнрих по программе ПИПСа, там же, ВВТ. И вот Даниил хочет сделать неофициальное объявление.
Есть предложение вечером пойти на пляж с шелками или покупаться, кто как хочет. Вот, то есть, и, наверное, когда закончится занятие, можно будет поделиться точнее с временем. Это одна мысль. А вторая мысль, я вижу, что многие фотографируют. Давайте как-то обменяемся фотографиями. Можно, например, посредством моего ноутбука это сделать. Кто хочет участвовать, дать или получить, это можно сделать.
Хорошо. Но это неофициально. То есть, комитет не несет никакой ответственности за это. Окей. Окей. Let's have another lecture and to go more deeply in the HPC technique. Okay.
Okay, so with the second part, we would at first look at the concepts of code parallelization, and then the task tomorrow will be that within the two lectures tomorrow we will get details to see how this is done with the message passing and so on, and to see how the libraries work. But today we will just make some principal consideration how to proceed with using these parallel environments. So the first question is, of course, what is just this parallelization? How do I write a parallel program? Well, just in general, the question is how to come from a regular program that I already have to one that is parallel and runs optimally on such a parallel environment. So we have to speak a little bit about tools that are available and about the algorithmic aspects, so which type of calculation is appropriate for which type of parallelization, for example. And then we will have a look at some examples, and I want to give some general explanation how we program these parallel things. And then tomorrow we will see how it is done in detail. So if we now have this environment where we have these many processors, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, then obviously we have to run tasks or parts of our program in parallel on these individual components. And the question is, of course, how do we find the parts that can run in parallel? So our task will be to find this implicit parallelism that is in the application and to make it somehow explicit. And usually it's done in the way that we either distribute programs to the individual processors or we distribute data. So the latter distribution of data is the one that is more easy and for most of the applications more appropriate. So you can just, as a simple first example, imagine that you have
a climate calculation, for example, and you have a huge area, let's say you want to compute the climate of Europe in the next 20 years, then, and you have 100 processors, then you just divide this area into 100 segments and give each segment to one of the processors. So this will be the basic principle for many applications that are run on these parallel environments. The question is, of course, who will do this work? And there are two options. Either the programmer will do it or the compiler will do it. And I can just tell you, forget about the compiler. They are too stupid, okay? Natural intelligence is the slogan, not artificial intelligence. They are still working hard on compiler optimization, so we see compiler approaches that do the parallelization, or try to do a parallelization automatically. But the problem is that the compilers do not have a real semantically correct view of what you want to do in your program. So obviously, their means of doing a parallelization automatically are just limited. And in most cases, it's just the genius of the programmer who has to take care of that. So, what do we do with the parallelization? Well, we have these many components. What we need to do is we have to distribute our computational parts onto these components. Okay? Of course, this distribution, again, produces some load. Because if it's completely distributed, then the individual components perhaps have to get in contact with each other, they have to communicate and see how far the other ones get, and this costs you performance. So obviously, this additional overhead here, this overhead would be minimal if we just do not distribute anything. If we just keep it on one computer, then there's no communication, everything's fine. By the way, this is the same like with, let's say, administrations of universities or in the state. So let's assume you want to go on a business trip and you give your declaration to one person and one person takes care of this. Everything goes well. But usually it's organized in a way that one person takes your documents, makes some calculation, gives it to the next person, this next person does something, gives it to the third person, and then you will have six persons or so until your request for a business trip will be granted. And so you lose a lot of, due by the communication that these individual people have with each other. I mean, this is really just like in real life. The more you distribute one task, the more these components have to coordinate each other, and the more overhead you have. So for short tasks, it might then, as we had with this example before, it might then be just a good idea not to parallelize it at all. But if you have many of these short tasks, just to put them onto the many nodes that you have. So, obviously, the overhead is minimal if you do not distribute at all. But, of course, the distribution uses then the resource optimally, because when you have 1,000 computers, you want to use all of them. And so that means optimal distribution costs you additional effort, but uses the machines optimally. And you somehow have to balance between these two factors. So you have to try to keep the overhead low, but nevertheless use all the components. The problem is that parallel programming is then a little bit more complicated as the sequential programming. What you usually have to do, so when we look at the applications, and then we have sequential applications just running on our computers, and then we have a parallel computer and we make a parallel application. So when the question is, for example, how many really new applications do we write which are from the start parallel applications, then I can say that this is a very low number. Maybe at the moment it's 5 to 10%. Most of the applications that we have on supercomputers are applications that we had before already, maybe for many years. We had them as sequential applications, and now we did the parallelization of the sequential code, which is complicated in a way, because at first, if you were not the author of the program, you have at first to understand the sequential program and then parallelize it. So if it's this way, and that's the usual case, then you have to partition this program into small tasks. They have somehow to coordinate,
and you have to enter some communication, and then you have to put these tasks onto the computer, for example. The problem, there will be several problems with that. The basic problem will be debugging. So imagine that you have one program, you divide it into 1,000 parts, you put the 1,000 parts onto 1,000 processors, and the program crashes on processor 732. All the others continue. 732 crashes. Well, the question is, what happened? What you cannot do is just to say, let's start a debugging session. We open 1,000 windows, and we follow what the processes do there. And then we see what happens. So debugging is really a huge problem. And in addition, we have one factor that as we now distribute the program onto several physically separated places in the world, because, I mean, you have one computer here and you have one there, the problem is that electricity needs some time to go to this place and that place. So we now get, as an additional factor in our programs, the factor of time. And as a consequence, very often, the program runs are not reproducible. So what frequently happens is the following. You run a program, it crashes. You say, okay, I will add some print statement in my code to see what the variables is. With entering this print statement in the code, you slow down the code a little bit, so the temporal behavior will be slightly different, and the error disappears. So you don't see anything. You take the print statement out again, so it changes back to the status that it had before, and the error reappears. So really, I mean, this is not a joke, it's really like this. When you observe it, it does not crash. And as soon as you stop to observe it, it crashes again. That happens frequently with parallel computing, and this takes the fun out of this stuff. Yeah? Because, I mean, there are not so real good debugging tools for taking care and handling this problem. And also, performance analysis is a point, because you must somehow find if there's a slowdown in your program, and this is particularly combined to this third point here, load balancing. It might be that some processes have too much work to do and other ones did already finish with their work, but you need to keep them busy all the time to get the maximum performance out of the environment. There are mathematical modelings for this, for example. And we don't go into details with this performance analysis, but you need tools for this, and then you have to do a tuning to keep everything busy during the program run, equally busy. That is not so complicated, but the most complicated part is the debugging. We will have new types of errors. They are time depending. They just appear and disappear, and they are sometimes on this computer, sometimes on that computer. If there is, in particular, non-determinism in our program, which we sometimes use, and that makes the debugging complicated. And tomorrow, then, when we will learn how to use the libraries for this, I will also tell you a little bit about which of the function calls we will use in the beginning, because in the beginning we try to make it as conservative as possible, which means we try to be cowards and do our programming really carefully in order to avoid this special type of time-depending errors. And only if then we see that the performance is okay, then we can change the program a little bit, and then it gets more dangerous. And believe me, even for beginners, I mean, even beginners in our lectures who write short programs, 100 lines of code, for example, just 3, 4, 5 statements of message passing, they put errors and mistakes into the source code, which takes them 2 weeks to find them. And I mean, these are small programs. Usually when we speak about computational fluid dynamics, then we have programs that have 500,000 lines of code or something like that. So this, the debugging aspect is really not at all trivial. Let's look at the parallelization paradigms. So the first paradigm is the code partitioning, also called pipelining or macro pipelining. Just imagine, for example, you do the calculation of some images. And you, for example, do some pre-processing. For example, you change the contrast of an image. Then you do the computation. For example, with our images, you will find out what the cells do. Will they just continue to live? Will they die? Will there be a mutation? Whatever. This is done in the computational part. And then you do a post-processing where you, for example, put colors into the image to show to the person what happens there. So you could imagine, for example, you have three steps for the for this task, and you have three machines. So you will put this one on the first machine, on the second machine, and this one on the third machine. And this will be an easy parallelization. The advantage is that sometimes this is really appropriate. For example, fast Fourier transformation can be done in this way. There are some algorithms for which this is okay. But the disadvantage is that if you do it this way, then of course you have multiple source files. You have one for the pre-processing, one source code for the processing, one for the post-processing. And this is difficult to handle. So in fact, we don't want to have this. And also imagine you have an application and you identified three parts, but then you have a parallel computer that has four processors, for example. So the three parts will not perfectly fit or map onto the four processors, but, so that's not a good solution then. Also, debugging is complicated, load balancing is complicated. So mainly the slide was to show you that this exists and to tell you that usually we don't do it this way because that is a little bit too complicated. Instead, what we do is data partitioning. For example, we have this Mandelbrot set here that needs to be computed, and we have an X, Y area, such a rectangular field here, where we want to do the computation. And we have, for example, four processors. So what we do is we divide this complete field into four segments. Each segment will be computed by one process, and we put this process onto one processor. So each processor has one process. That's the optimal way to do it, because then the processor is just 100% used by this single process. And each process does just a calculation of such a segment. If the segments are of equal size, for many applications at least, if the segments are of equal size, this will mean equal computation time for all the individual processes. And that is perfect. So everything is balanced then here. The advantage is that this is, in fact, more or less easy to program. We only have one source code that does the computation. We can easily adapt it to different machines. Because, for example, imagine we do not have four processors, but instead we have 4,000. Then we just divide this area into 4,000 segments and put each segment onto one processor. That is also very nice because usually you have regular data structures. Very frequently these are matrices, for example. And then also the debugging, which is complicated, gets a little bit easier. Okay, so that's why I call it relatively easy. It's more complicated than with regular programs, but it's easier than with this code partitioning. Disadvantages, well, in fact, no real big disadvantages. Sometimes there are some applications where the other concept is more appropriate, but there are not so many of these. So this is the standard way of doing it. And because it is the standard way, so the de facto standard, this is also called SPMD, single program, multiple data, which means we have one program code written. We make from this one program code, for example, 1,000 process instances, so 1,000 processes. We put onto each processor one of these processes, and each process computes one segment of the complete amount of data, of the overall data. So the 1,000 part, so to say, of it, for example. Let me just finish this and then. What we sometimes see nowadays, which is a little bit more appropriate in some cases, but also increases the complexity, is a mixture of these two principles. So for example, that you say, I have the computational part, or let's say this picture recognition, artificial intelligence thing. The computation is very complex, so I need many processors to get this done in a reasonable time. But also I need to do some pre-processing, and also I need to do some post-processing. So sometimes what the programmers do is to say, okay, this here is one process, and together with the process that does the computation here, one third of the computation, I put these two on one machine, I put that on the second machine and these two on the third machine. So it's then a mixture of the code partitioning and the data partitioning. Sometimes we see this in particular, for example, with this thing with our microscopes, because we have these pre-processing tasks, which are not very time-consuming, and post-processing tasks, which are time-consuming. For example, the post-processing that we do with the pictures is the following. When you have from one cell 100 pictures and a time series, so between each picture there's 1 minute or 30 seconds or something like that, then they make out of these 100 time series pictures a small MPEG film that the user can then watch. And then the biologist can watch the film and say, okay, I see this and that mutation going on with the cell. So there is some post-processing, which in fact is very easy because you just put the pictures together and make a small film out of it. That's trivial, not time-consuming, but the analysis of the pictures is very time-consuming.
Небольшие комментарии, что работа с написанием программ для параллельного вычисления большое искусство, скажем так, и проблемы возникают разные в том, как построить алгоритм, и особенно, конечно, в отлаживании программ. То есть это не как обычное программирование. Ошибки у вас могут быть зависящие от времени. То есть вы запустили задачу на разных процессорах, и у вас там, допустим, 100 процессоров работает, в одном случилась ошибка. Вы все не можете отладить их, посмотреть, что там делает каждый процессор. Обычно можно это дело отладить путем внесения комментарий print, да, вот здесь вот распечатаем данные, и здесь, возможно, будет ошибка. Но вам исполнение кода print, оно задержит вам выполнение задач на этом процессоре, и у вас времена как бы разойдутся, и ошибка может исчезнуть. Но если вы эту строку с информированием данных о себе уберете, то ошибка снова возникнет. То есть отлаживание программы – это очень затруднительная задача. Какие способы есть распараллеливания? Первое – по алгоритму. Если у вас есть какой-то алгоритм, который можете представить в виде нескольких кусков, вы можете каждый кусок программы, там, допустим, пустить на отдельный процессор. Проблема в том, что у вас, допустим, в алгоритме 4 части, а процессора всего 3. То есть вы заранее не можете знать, сколько у вас будет процессоров. И поэтому тут возникают определенные трудности. Поэтому проще всего распараллеливать задачу по данным. И, как правило, чаще всего люди этим и пользуются. Если у вас есть обработка какого-нибудь массива данных, например, картинки, вы можете разбить ее на несколько равных частей, каждую часть обработки данных исполнять один и тот же код, но на разных процессорах. Это легче ошибки отлавливать, легче программировать и легче распараллеливать. То есть желательно использовать всегда алгоритмы, которые распараллеливают вашу задачу по данным, разбивая данные на какие-то куски и потом их обрабатывая. Ну и здесь вот есть комплексный подход и тот и другой вариант. Окей. Okay. Ну, потому что, допустим, процессоры работают параллельно, да, и они синхронизированы по времени. Если вы внесли в один процессор программу print, она вызывает несколько задержки процессора, и у вас происходит, ну, десинхронизация, грубо говоря, так. Поэтому, как бы, немного данные изменяются, и, допустим, эта ошибка, она вот этим printf-ом, она у вас, как бы, скрывается. Но если вы его убрали... Опять,
не видно или нет?
Она есть, но она не проявляется.
Был диплом, да. Но
да.
Присутствие
освободился, и все. Да. Допустим, в какой-то момент нужно было зарезервировать память какую-то, да, а в это время она была занята другим процессором. И, значит, вы вставили print, немножко время сдвинулось, у вас второй процессор эту память освободил, и в данном случае вы можете свободно там, допустим, занимать. И ошибки нету. Но если вы этот print убрали, значит, вот память снова оказалась забитой, и у вас возникла ошибка. То есть вот такие хитрости, это, в общем, довольно-таки тонкая вещь. Желательно минимизировать усилия, вот распараллели по данным. Когда у вас одна программа, вы точно знаете, что она выполняется на одном процессоре и так далее.
Let's come back to this tomorrow when we speak about the message parsing interface. Because I will show you with which operations this can show up and which is a conservative way to avoid it. Unfortunately, it's like this. The conservative way to avoid it gives you perhaps less performance with the parallel application. So if you are more courageous, you do something like non-blocking receive operations, for example, then you get more performance out of it, but you get the danger of non-determinism, which has a consequence in these errors that sometimes show up and sometimes disappear.
Далее более подробно будет рассказано, что за ошибки какого типа бывают и как их избегать.
Okay, so far for the parallelization paradigms, the principal concepts of how to do that. Now let's have a look at the tools that are available. We distinguish here several levels of abstraction. The highest level is that everything is done automatically, and the lowest level is that everything is done with libraries and handmade programming. So this is where we are in reality, in fact. We are a little bit higher maybe, but in fact, it's mainly handwritten code that we have on the parallel machines. Okay, nevertheless, let's have a look at these approaches. So one, the best would be that everything is done by compilers automatically. The next best, that it's done by compilers, but we must help them a little bit. Then we see something that we call parallel languages, which is, when you look at C and Fortran, for example, these are regular languages, and there exist also so-called parallel languages where the possibility of parallelism is an element of the language itself. So you program in a way where you don't see this parallelism, but after that, with the compiler, it is parallelized. There are some approaches, they were not successful, so we don't see that very often in reality. Then we have parallel extensions for existing sequential languages, and we have these parallel programming libraries. So let's go through these five levels and have a short look what we see here. Automatic parallelization. This is done, you can imagine this, for example, for Fortran, also for C, but it was popular for Fortran. And what an automatic parallelizing compiler does is, in particular, it automatically parallelizes loops. So imagine you have a loop in your program. Let's say you have a for loop. You have for x equal 1 to 1,000, do something. Then you have 1,000 iterations through this loop. And if you are lucky, the code in the loop is programmed in a way that there are no data dependencies. And then what you can do is, just as an example, you have 1,000 iterations, you have 10 processors, then each processor gets 100 iterations. And this is easy, this can be easily done, if, for example, with this Mandelbrot set, the for loop goes over the points of your area, and the points are independent. So if we do not have the situation that there's a dependency in the sense that point x depends on the value of point x minus 1. If this is not the case, then the compiler can parallelize it perfectly and automatically. Unfortunately, we don't see much of such codes. Yeah? Most codes are so complicated inside this body of the for statement, of the for loop, that the compiler cannot tell whether there are data dependencies or not. And if the compiler cannot tell, then it says, well, I don't know. So it's safe not to parallelize it, and you end up with a just regular sequential program. Yeah, so the capabilities of a compiler to detect this automatically are limited. To parallelize it, if it detects it, that is absolutely simple, because we just spread the loop indices over several processes, but the detection is the problem. So usually we see these compilers also for vectorizing machines, and usually this has bad performance. So for the Cray supercomputers, for example, with a parallelizing compiler, from the 100% theoretical performance of the processor, you in the end get perhaps 2% or 3% into your application because the compiler does such a bad work. And this is still research, but not too much progress in that field in the last years. Then we have something like manually parallelizing compilers. We have something that we use for the shared memory architectures, a concept that is only some 5-6 years old, OpenMP. And with OpenMP, what we do is that we give comments in the program and tell the compiler, this loop can be parallelized and that one cannot be parallelized. And we as a programmer, as we wrote the code, we know the details, we know whether there are data dependencies or not, and so we can make a correct statement for the compiler, and then the compiler is sure that if it does the parallelization, it will also give a correct result. That is now getting more and more popular. It will be in the future an important part of parallel programming, and I think if I come back maybe in 2 years, then we have to replace parts of the slides from this message passing interface with the OpenMP standard. And also in the future, what we will see is a combined usage of OpenMP for shared memory, because we have these multi-core environments, and message passing between the boxes on which OpenMP runs. So then parallel language extensions. There was one thing called high performance Fortran. That is more a parallel language itself. High performance Fortran was started in 1990, in the early 1990s, and it was stopped, I would say, in the year 2000 because it was a complete flop. So they just were not able to produce a good compiler for this. And in the end, the thing was dead and is now buried more or less. And we don't see much progress in this field. I mean, there's some research going on, but nothing that is productive as a compiler. So then we have the libraries, and this is the abstraction level on which we will work, that we say the concept is just to spawn independent processes, but that means to start them on the process source, and depending on what the application needs, then you have to introduce some communication between these processes. And there are two libraries available which do this. One is a library that is more old-fashioned. It is from the beginning of the 90s. Very seldom people use this now. And then we have this MPI, which is the concept that is now the standard concept for programming of parallel applications. This is what we will speak about tomorrow in detail, so I will just mention the name now and then tomorrow explain the details of that. Now maybe we'll just interrupt.
Okay. Значит, среди способов распараллеления есть, ну, точнее так, программных средств распараллеления есть несколько категорий. Первое – это встроенный параллелизм. Это, например, в Fortran у вас есть цикл, который, допустим, надо пересчитать 1000 точек вот этой картинки, причем независимо. Вы и компилятор может сам понять, вот, что в этом случае можно этот цикл из 1000 точек разделить на 10 процессоров, каждый процессор считает там, допустим, свою точку эту. И здесь никаких проблем нет до тех пор, пока вычисление данных в одной точке не зависит у вас от соседних точек и от состояний. Тогда у вас результаты будут неправильные, и поэтому параллелить такие коды нельзя. Значит, как правило, автоматических компиляторов, ну, которые сами за человека распараллеливают, они существуют, но их эффективность очень мала. Если вы, допустим, ожидаете в идеале 100% улучшения эффективности счета, то на уровне компиляторов сборки автоматическое распараллеление дает только 2%. То есть человек, вклад человека очень важен здесь, и избежать этого нельзя, никак не обойти. Значит, то есть проблема в том, что если у вас компилятор программы автоматически циклы эти распараллеливает, проблема в том, что если он у вас не должен быть распараллелен, то у вас возникает ошибка. Поэтому возникла такая парадигма, называется OpenMP, когда программист сам пишет, вот этот цикл можно распараллелить, дает некую команду, значит, а этот цикл нельзя распараллеливать. И тогда он сам контролирует вот эти вот циклы и эффективно может распараллелить программу. И за этим как бы в будущее это очень удобное средство программирования, то есть не требует особенных интеллектуальных усилий. То есть вы знаете, что у вас цикл этот по точкам независимый, вы просто говорите параллелить здесь, и у вас программа сама посчитает, сколько процессоров, сколько там нужно, насколько разбить эти данные и так далее. Значит, что еще? Про Fortran компилятор сказали, что он уже умер, то есть типа, оказался полностью неэффективным. Значит, то есть это не решение проблемы, к сожалению. И еще есть библиотеки программ, это некие наборы подпрограмм, которые позволяют вам работать, они реализуют доступ к различным частям суперкомпьютерной системы, вы можете их использовать, допустим, обратиться к памяти одного процессора, переслать сообщения между несколькими процессорами и так далее. Окей. Есть вопросы какие-то? Окей.
So basically we have these two nowadays we have these two concepts, MPI that does the message passing and OpenMP that gives hints to the compiler how to do a parallelization. And then of course the next question is, what is the relation between these parallelization concepts and the hardware that we have? Because we have shared memory hardware or multi-core hardware now and distributed memory hardware. And basically, you can use all these concepts on all of these architectures, but not with optimal performance. So if you want to have optimal performance, what you usually do is you have threads and automatic parallelization. This is just what OpenMP does on a shared memory architecture or such a multi-core environment, for example. And you have libraries for message passing on architectures that have distributed memory. Because it is then optimally adapted to the underlying hardware. So if we look at the algorithms, then the world is divided in two big classes. By the way, the first class is huge and the second class is pretty small. The first huge class is all these numerical applications. Usually they are called grand challenge algorithms because they are very complicated to program and then very time consuming to compute the results. And time-consuming, for example, are things like weather forecast, protein design, car crash simulation, things like that. And on the other hand, neighboring these numerical algorithms, we see so-called non-numerical algorithms, like that we use in theory provers, for example, game programs, chess-playing programs, for example, but also database applications, which means these are all applications that do not deal with numbers. The supercomputers always also have this nickname number cruncher because what they do is just to compute millions and thousands of millions of numbers in a numerical application, and it's not so widespread, it's not so frequent to have non-numerical applications on supercomputers. It's getting more over the years, but still the percentage of non-numerical applications on high-performance computers, I would say, is below 5%, and the rest is just numerical applications. So with the numerical applications, what do we have? For example, computational fluid dynamics, wind tunnel simulation, things like that, optimizations of any kind, simulations of any kind, what a cell does inside. There are so many things that you can simulate. What is the structure of these algorithms typically? Usually these are, or very often these are iterative algorithms. So what they do is they try to compute a solution for a problem. They do it in an iterative way, which means they try to get closer and closer to the correct solution. They cannot get to the absolute correct solution, but when they are close enough, they just stop. So you say there's an error limit, and if the calculation result is below that limit, then we stop. So they are iterative. Very, very many of them are iterative. Then they finish with the computation when some global condition is true. For example, when the result is precise enough, then they just stop with the computation. They have very often regular data structures. That is good for the parallelization. They have vectors, for example, matrices, which are usually easy to parallelize. When you have a vector and it's 1 million elements long and you have 1,000 processors, then just each processor gets 1,000 elements. So that could be a primitive parallelization that might already lead to a perfect result. We see that frequently. Caused by the fact that we have regular data structures, we also usually have regular communication structure. I will come back to this when we look at the examples. And also a static process structure because, for example, we divide the matrix into 1,000 submatrices, give each submatrix to one process, and then compute with 1,000 processes on 1,000 processors the task, and that's it. There's no change during the runtime. With non-numerical applications, this is just the opposite. So, for example, a good typical non-numerical application is everything that is a tree search. I will come back to this later with an example and visualize this a little bit. Tree search is that you say, for example, for chess playing, you have a position on your chessboard, you have four different moves that you can make, and then you get four following positions, and then for each position you have a number of moves that you can make, and this spans such a tree.
And what you are interested in is the question, which sequence of moves leads to the effect that I win the game, for example. So you search through this tree that can be computed, and you look for a solution. These are typical things. Also, theorem proving, for example, works that way. But the effect is that the data structures are no longer matrices. They are trees, and these are more complicated to parallelize. So you will get irregular communication structures and things like that. Sometimes you would want to change the number of processes during the program run. And, well, there are all sorts of problems in this field here. And, well, it's not the typical field for a parallel computer. And if you have applications, then they are typically not easy to parallelize. So as a consequence, we don't see many of these applications on our parallel machines. Only a few percent are in this category. As a first summary, we can say that the paradigm for parallelization is either data partitioning, that's the most prominent one, the one that we usually follow, or code partitioning, that is done not so frequently. Then we have tools for parallel programming. So the most important is compilers and libraries, where the compiler does the parallelization manually. This is just this OpenMP compiler, because we tell the compiler where to do parallelization. And most important is then here the natural intelligence that we put into that, in particular when we use the MPI libraries. We will see that tomorrow. And the world is divided into two classes, numerical and non-numerical applications, where the numerical ones make perhaps 95% of all the applications that we see on parallel computers.
Вот по поводу типов алгоритмов, существует два типа алгоритмов, которые могут быть использоваться. Это численные и нечисленные алгоритмы. Значит, к численным относится, собственно говоря, задача перемалывания чисел, когда вам нужно пересчитать матрицу умноженную друг на друга, там, допустим. Вот это то же самое, что задача взаимодействия белков или там, расчета их координат, когда вы просто рассчитываете очень много данных. Вот, они хороши тем, что они итеративные, завершаются по какому-то глобальному условию остановки. У них есть регулярные структуры данных, это матрицы и вектора, как правило. И, в общем, цель заключается в том, что надо пересчитать огромное число чисел. Это перемалывание чисел. Второй тип алгоритмов – это не вычислительный алгоритм. Вот здесь к таким, наверное, имеет смысл отнести наши сети, метаболические генные сети, когда есть структура графа. Надо, допустим, найти там пути по графам. Эта задача сильно связанная, оказывается, и поэтому их очень трудно распараллелить. То есть это, в общем-то, и таких примеров хорошо распараллелить. Ну и вот здесь вот говорил, задача – это шахматная партия, когда машина должна просчитать последовательно все возможные ходы всех возможных фигур там, значит, и принять некое решение, какой ход оптимальный. Ей нужно перебирать все возможные варианты. Это такая структура дерева. Вы двигаетесь каждый раз на каждом шагу, новую веточку открываете, там, начиная с разных ходов. Вот, и такие задачи параллелиться очень трудно. И успешных примеров решения таких задач для таких систем, для параллельных систем, около 5%. Остальное все перемалывание чисел. То есть вот как мы видим, что не все алгоритмы изначально могут быть хорошо переложены вот на такие параллельные системы. Окей.
So we will now have a look at some examples and see how you can do the parallelization in principle. And we go through one example from the numerical application and discuss how to partition this. Then we will have a short look onto a fluid dynamic example, which is a wind tunnel simulation. And we will have a short look at some tree search algorithm, because these classes here that we touch are the main classes of applications that you will find on a parallel computer. And we do all this manually, and we do it for architectures with shared memory and for architectures with distributed memory. And for the first example, we will go into some details and discuss the differences between these two approaches. And for the other two, we will just follow the message passing concept and get some details how it is done there. So example number one is a numerical program, just a primitive one. So imagine you have just three functions, f, g, and h, and you apply the three functions to some data. And then what you have is h from g from f from x. So you apply the three functions onto one data element x and get a result, and that's it. What we now will discuss are two cases, or in fact four cases. We discuss the partitioning, the code partitioning and the data partitioning, and we discuss it for shared memory and for distributed memory and see how the differences are. So example number one in the case of code partitioning, and this brings us also back to the question that you asked here, where the parallelism is, because you will see how you can make it in a way that it will not work correctly, in the beginning at least. So code partitioning, people sometimes think, for example, here with this application, they say, okay, we have three functions to be applied. We have one, we have the data, and we apply the functions onto the data. So, for example, we can make three processes. This is a typical case of code partitioning. And each process computes just one of the functions. So we have one process that computes the f from x, one that that computes the g, and one that computes the h. So what we do is, let's say we have a vector of data, 1,000 elements, for example, that we put the first element into this process. This process is on one processor, that one is on one processor, and that one is on one processor. We put the first element into this process. It computes f from x and hands over the result to g. I mean, f from x might be g apostrophe, and now you compute g from this x apostrophe, get a new result, and compute the h from this new x that you have here, and then you have the final result here in the end. So, looks okay, but I mean, what's the problem here? It doesn't work in parallel, because what happens is, you put the first data in here, move it there, and get the result. But meanwhile, this thing here is completely empty, the pipeline. So this is a good, I mean, this example here is something that will be typically be programmed on a shared memory architecture with threads. And what the beginners then see is that with three threads, it has exactly the same performance as with one thread. And then they wonder and say, well, but it should be three times faster, and it is not. And the reason is that they made an error here with this concept. We will just come back to this and see how to improve it. So at the moment, with a very primitive approach, it looks parallel, but it does not work in parallel. And this happens frequently. And I would say, one main problem that we have with the parallel programming is that the human brain is really not appropriate to overlook what the dynamic of a parallel program does when it is running. We can just not evaluate in our brain what's going on there. So we have some experience, then for example an experienced programmer immediately sees that this here will not work in parallel. But there will be other cases where even experienced programmers will not be able to say what will go on dynamically during the program run. Instead, they have just to test it and see. Okay, we'll come back to that just in a minute. The data partitioning would work in the following way, that we say we write one program code. The one program code computes the h from g from f from x. So we have one program written. We start, we have three processors. From this one program, we start three processes. We put each process on one processor. And as we now have three processes on the three processors, we give to each process 1/3 of the input data. So imagine it's 3,000 values that you have to compute. Then each process gets just 1,000 values. Computes the h from g from f from x from its 1,000 values. Gives us the result, and we have to collect this somewhere, put it together, and that's then the final result. And this is then the data partitioning. So with the code partitioning, let's look at some details. The most primitive approach with the code partitioning would work like this. You have the values, you put them into a vector. Let's say you have 3,000 values. And you have three processes, and what you do is that you say process E computes it takes the first element, computes the intermediate result, and sends it to the next process. So we have three processes. The first one takes the first element, computes the intermediate value, sends it to the second process, it computes a new intermediate value, sends it to the third, and then it's done. So you see, it looks parallel, but nothing happens in parallel. It just walks through this pipeline, but there's no real pipeline effect. So it will not work correctly. And this happens frequently with beginners. The beginners say, well, I have three threads. Why is it not three times so quick, so fast? Well, the reason is you made an error with the program. Instead, what we have to do is we have to improve this code in the following way, as an example, that we say when the process... when the process has computed its value, it sends it immediately to the neighbor, but also then gets from the other ones a new value such that the pipeline is filled. And in this case, we have something that is called a good parallelization, but the problem is that we have lots of communication that takes place, because for every element, we send it from one process to the other. Which means for each element that we compute, we have one communication to send it to the next process, and this is just too much communication. And then it works in parallel, but the ratio between communication and computation is not very good. There's just too much communication going on. Just like as if 10 civil servants work in the administration on your request for a business trip, and everybody does on your formula where you fill in your data just one small thing that it enters there. Yeah. If you parallelize it too much, then the performance will be bad. Good. So the next improvement...
Okay, maybe some will, comments? Some
comments? Let me just finish this. Okay. The next improvement will be just like this, that you say, for example, I have 1 million elements to be computed. I take the first 1,000, give it to the first process. It computes the results, gives the 1,000 results to the second process, and in that meantime, the first process gets the second 1,000, so that the pipeline is filled, and the transfer of data that you do is not for each individual element of these 1 million elements, but for always a package of 1,000 elements. So once you have computed 1,000 elements, you will send the intermediate results of these 1,000 elements to the next process, and then it computes this function, well, that was function F, then function G. It computes the intermediate values and sends it to the third process that computes function H. And by doing this, we have the advantage that this is still a good parallel implementation, and this communication-computation ratio is much better here. Disadvantage is that it needs a little bit. So, for example, when we compute the first 1,000, well, pipeline goes from this side to that side. When we compute the first 1,000 elements on the process that computes the F function, then it computes the F function for 1,000 elements, but during this time, the process that computes function G and the process that compute function H are not doing anything. They are idle. So it needs some time to fill the pipeline. Once the first 1,000 elements are computed, they are transferred to the second process. The first one gets another 1,000 from these 1 million that we have. So two processes are busy. One is not doing anything. And then only after 3,000 values being computed, all of the three are busy. And then the pipeline is filled, and the pipeline will be kept busy all the time until in the end, it's the case that the pipeline empties also from this side to that side. And there's a little bit of inefficiency then in these two phases.
Пример задачи, которая может быть распараллельна, но зависит от трех шагов, и которые должны быть выполнены последовательно. Например, вам нужно для моделирования белка сначала найти гомолога, затем промоделировать его структуру и затем, допустим, посчитать докинг какой-то. Вот у вас три стадии процесса. Как его распараллелить? Можно, конечно, то есть все они должны быть выполнены последовательно, и вам нужно это сделать для тысячи белков. Один из вариантов – это когда вы первый процесс, и вы разбиваете задачу. Один компьютер у вас или один процессор считает выравнивание, второй моделирует структуру белка, а третий, там, допустим, разрабатывает лекарство, докинг делает белка этого. У вас тысяча таких белков. Что вы делаете? Первый способ – это вы считаете выравнивание белка, передаете его на второй процессор, Там он, значит, его структура моделируется, а пока моделируется структура, вы на первом процессе считаете уже второй белок. То есть у вас данные подаются вот в такой очереди, да, и дальше идут по цепочке. Пока, допустим, работает один, второй для первого белка, предыдущий процессор считает уже для второго белка. И в этом смысле как бы вы можете эффективно данные эти разделить. Проблема в том, что вычисления, они гораздо более быстрые, чем передача данных, потому что процессоры связаны медленной связью. И у вас огромное время будет затрачено на передачу данных между счетными машинами. Вот. Чтобы этого избежать, обычно данные группируют по тысячам, допустим, и это делается быстрее. Передача группы данных, пакета, она гораздо более быстрая, вы экономите время. Но в этом случае вам, пока досчитается 1000 ваших белков на первом процессоре, два других стоят и ждут. Потом, значит, вы передали на второй процессор, стоит, ждет третий. То есть вот эта задержка, она будет как бы неизбежна. И это тоже недостаток этого подхода. Окей.
So when you have this pipelining, the processes are different. Different processes have different tasks by the definition, and obviously they have a different speed of working. And your whole speed of the pipeline is determined by the slowest one.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with that? Because your load is not smoothly distributed between nodes.
Yeah. You are absolutely right, and the question was how to deal with the fact that, for example, the three functions FG and H could be computationally different, so with different time. In this case, you will not do code partitioning. As I said before, code partitioning is not so frequent because it makes more problems with the programming, and what you say is exactly one of the crucial points against code partitioning. So here, for example, when I know that the three steps are of equal size, the FG and H function, for example, then I can do that easily. But as soon as there's a time difference in the computation, in the computational duration, that I will not be able to solve the problem of load balancing within the pipeline. So I will no longer stick to the code partitioning paradigm. Instead, I will make data partitioning. But that is exactly the crucial point.
Why do you have code partitioning at all, then?
Sometimes you have code partitioning because you use it as one part in a combined approach. For example, with our pictures, we have a pre-processing in the beginning that is not intensive, and we have a post-processing in the end that is also not intensive. And in the middle, there's a processing of the data which is very intensive. So the processing in the middle is put as data partitioning onto many processors, and then you use one processor in the beginning for the pre-processing and one processor in the end for the post-processing. And then, as a combination of the two principles, it makes sense. As a pure principle, let's say a pure code partitioning, we almost never see that. Sometimes in very small special environments where you, for example, when you control some machine with embedded computing or so, sometimes they do things like that. But these are very special environments with some special hardware.
Комментарий, что такой алгоритм может работать только тогда, когда у вас все программы примерно одинаковое время работают. Допустим, поиск гомологов – это секунды, а моделирование структуры белка – это часы. Ну а докинг – это уже, допустим, могут дни занимать. Поэтому у вас в итоге будет на третьем процессоре все, значит, вертеться до тех пор, пока не посчитается. И в итоге вы ничего не выиграете практически.
So, with the with data partitioning, if you now we have the code partitioning before. If we now use the data partitioning and we use it with distributed memory, it will work in this way that you say we distribute the values over our nodes. For example, we have 3,000 values and we have, no, let's say 3 million values, and we have 3,000 nodes. So each node will get, what did I say, 3 million? 3 million values, 3,000 nodes. Okay, each node will get 1,000 values. And then we distribute the values over the nodes. Each process on each of the nodes, one node has one processor. Let's assume this for simplicity. Each process then computes just its part. and sends it to some master process who puts everything together. For example, it was an array or a vector or a matrix or whatever, puts it together and then writes it to disk, for example. So this is then a very good parallel implementation, and it also will give you a perfect performance. Because you have these millions of data in the beginning, you distribute them equally onto the processes on your processors, and then when the computation is finished, you just get the values back. And it's good for the parallelization. It's not always like this. Not all applications are like this, but it's good for a parallelization because once you have distributed data to the processors, the processes on the processors do not have to communicate. Everybody can just compute its H from G from F independently with the data that they have and send the result back. This is not true for all applications. We will just see that. This is something that is called, that there's a technical term for that. We call this embarrassingly parallel, because that is the most perfect parallelism that you can find in an application. And this will give you the maximum power out of the machine. I would say 10% of the applications, 20% of the applications are in this category. And this is really peaceful programming, so to say, peaceful parallelization, which will not produce some dirty errors that are difficult to find, and also give you a perfect performance of the parallel machine. So disadvantages, of course, but this is only a small point, that you have to program this distribution. So you have the 3 million values in the beginning, for example, and then you have to program that the vector is divided in 1,000 elements of equal size and send this to the processes. Well, that is can be done easily. Let's look at another example where it gets more complicated, and this is something like a wind tunnel simulation, for example. Just as a simple example, imagine the fact that we have in a wind tunnel such a car with a certain shape, and we want to compute how it behaves in this wind tunnel to see whether the form of the car is somehow efficient for the wind or not. And what you do, I mean, there are several approaches, but what you can do is that you divide, you see it here with the yellow lines, they're a little bit thin, that you divide this complete area, the so-called control volume, that you divide the control volume into four segments. And you have one segment here, and one there, and one there. And then it depends a little bit what you want to know. So there are two different approaches. One is the so-called microscopic approach. For the microscopic approach, you put some particles into this control volume, particles here. Particle has some velocity vector and then flies here through this control volume. If you make it with single particles, then of course the particles will have collisions, and you have to compute the collisions to find out what's going on here. And for example, when the application runs for a while, then you will see that you will have more particles here in front of the car, because they will just hit the front part and stay in this area, whereas here in the back, it will be much thinner. There will be less particles because of the wind flows away in that area here and gets thinner density of particles in the back of the car. The opposite approach is the so-called macroscopic approach. So we do not use individual particles because the computation with the individual particles is complicated. Instead, we just are interested in things like pressure, temperature, particle density in general. So what if people are interested in the second thing here, macroscopic approach, then what they do is they put a grid on top of this control volume, a very fine grid, and compute the values for pressure and temperature and density, for example, for each of these grid points. And this is a different algorithmic approach, and sometimes you need the microscopic one, sometimes you go with the macroscopic one. What we want to discuss here is just the microscopic approach, where we have the individual particles. This gives you a very exact simulation of what's going on in the wind tunnel, but as it is very exact, it's also very time-consuming. And we just want to see how you do the parallelization in this case.
The first option will be that you say we distribute the particles. So with this particle approach, we have to do the following thing. These particles, they enter the control volume here, and they fly through the control volume and leave it there. And we have to compute their way through this control volume. And in particular, what is complicated, we have to compute the collisions that they have. So, with a set of particles, let's imagine you have 1,000 particles which fly through the control volume. What you have to do is, you have to inspect all possible pairs of particles. So you take one particle and look at the other 999, and you have to find out whether they will collide, and if they collide, at what time. And you have to do this for all particles, and you have to find the shortest time, which is just the time for the next collision in my control volume. Then if you know this time, for example, you know that in the next millisecond there will be a collision of this particle and that particle, then what you do is you move forward all 1,000 particles for this 1 millisecond. The 1 millisecond is just the time after which we have the next collision, the earliest collision. So you move all particles for 1 millisecond. Nothing will happen except for the two particles which will have the collision after 1 millisecond. So after you move them, you will just compute their new velocity vectors, because they might collide and fly away in another direction. And then you continue with the computation. This is one iteration cycle. Then again, you try to find the next shortest point of time when the next collision will take place. And so you see, this is what you have to do with this microscopic approach. And you can imagine that it is very time consuming, because usually we do not have 1,000 particles. Instead, we have perhaps 10 million particles. So it's time consuming to find the ones which collide. Okay, coming back to the partitioning. First way of partitioning is that you say we distribute the particles equally. So let's assume we have 1 million of particles, and let's assume we have 1,000 processors. So each processor gets 1,000 particles. Altogether it's 1 million particles. But once you have distributed it in this way, it is very difficult to find the colliding partners. Because it might be that a particle on processor 1 is the one which will have just a collision with another particle, but that is on processor 700-something. So all particles have to be compared with all other particles, and as the particles are equally spread over the processors, this will be extremely difficult to find the particles that are neighboring and the ones that have the next collision. So it's a disadvantage. You will not be able to program. We will not do this type of programming. But the problem is that we have this big disadvantage here. Well, this is really a big one, so that's why we will not do it this way. But there would also be one advantage here, and the advantage would be that once we have distributed that way, we will have an equal distribution during the complete time of the computation. This would be good. So the advantage the advantage is big, but the disadvantage is very big. So that's why we don't do it this way. Instead, what we do is that we make it the other way around. We distribute the volume segments. So let's go quickly back to the picture. We make it this way, that we make 4 segments, like in this picture. Each segment has some particles, so it will be easy to find out where we have a collision, because a collision will always only take place between neighboring particles, obviously. This one will find the shortest time for the collision of his particles, this one will search for its own particles, this one for its particles, and that one for its particles. Then they will exchange messages, and for example say, one process says, I have a next collision in 1 millisecond, and the other one say, my next collision lasts 5 milliseconds. Then they know which one is the next one, and they compute the collision here, and for example these two would collide here at that point. Let's assume they collide here.
then the two particles collide here, you get new velocity vectors, and the computation continues. When we do it like this, and we distribute not the particles, instead we distribute the control volume, then we have another situation with the parallelization. Because what happens is that after a while, for example, this particle here, within the 1 millisecond for the next collision, it flies out of the segment of P1 into the segment of P2. So what I have to do is I have to take this data of the particle and send it via a message from process 1 to process 2 and tell process 2, well, you are the one who is now responsible for this particle. Even this is not a disadvantage. I mean, you have to program that. It can be programmed easily. It's not a disadvantage at the moment. What the disadvantage of this approach is the following. Over time, so in the beginning, the particles are equally distributed. The density is equal. But over time, the following will happen. We will have many more particles here in front of the car because they collide here and stay in this area. And we will have an area of thin particle density here. And this means after a time of computation, this process here will be overloaded and this one here will be underloaded. And you will get a severe load imbalance, and this will slow down because then also again with the iteration it's the same thing. The end of the iteration is determined by the slowest of the processors, and this one has to do a lot of work, this one has no work, so this one will be empty will be ready immediately, and this one will finish later. And that is bad. So for the For this type of data distribution, we have the disadvantage that the varying number of particles leads to bad load imbalance. I would say the disadvantage is big, and we will use some more programming to get rid of some of this disadvantage. But the advantage is that the neighboring partners can be easily found, and the advantage is very big. So the advantage here is much bigger than the disadvantage, and that's definitely a reason why we will use this concept for the parallelization. So when we have these molecular dynamic programs, and you also find that in chemistry and bioinformatics sometimes, if you have these molecular dynamic programs, you will usually not distribute the data of the particles, but you will distribute the data of this control volume, and then try somehow to handle the load imbalance that will show up during the program run.
Okay. Вот здесь были на таком примере обдувания машины воздухом были приведены три концепции распараллеливания. Но здесь можно взять вместо машины белок, допустим, и рассчитать его взаимодействие с молекулами воды. То есть поместив его в раствор, это какая-то вот такая штука большая, и вокруг нее плавают молекулы воды. Задача то же самое. Или там, допустим, лиганд какой-то вокруг белка пытается с ним связаться. Один из вариантов – это когда мы у нас есть там, допустим, 10 процессоров, 1000 молекул воды, и мы каждую молекулу воды пускаем следить, и пусть она обсчитывается процессором, грубо говоря. Проблема в том, что молекулы воды сталкиваются между собой, и этот момент мы должны данные от одного после столкновения изменяются у них скорости и координаты и так далее. Значит, мы должны между этими процессорами, чтобы они друг другу передали, ага, я с тобой столкнулся и так далее. Вот на это время, на это может уйти большое время. То есть очень трудно контролировать вот процессы столкновения, пересчитывать данные. Второй вариант, это, как я понял, это если мы... да, мы размещаем. Второй вариант это когда мы разбиваем наш объем данных на кусочки, и в каждом объеме мы следим за молекулами. Очень легко отслеживать их столкновение, потому что это все делается в одном процессоре. Но недостаток заключается в том, что мы должны отслеживать пересечение из одного объема в другой сообщением между процессорами. Но это как бы можно легко решить. Основной недостаток заключается в том, что есть объемы, где молекул много скапливается, а есть объемы, в которых молекулы мало скапливаются. Поэтому один процессор будет очень много работы выполнять, а второй будет очень слабо загруженным. И это недостаток, то есть несбалансированность работы процессоров. Но тем не менее утверждается, что этот недостаток, тем не менее, он гораздо менее вреда наносит, чем вот, ускорение за счет обработки частиц одновременно, оно гораздо более ценное, чем вот, неравномерная загрузка процессоров.
Пожалуйста.
The problem is that here, for example, the yellow lines, you would not do it like this in a real application. Instead, you would make the yellow lines such that this area and this area here are equally sized. The problem is that in the beginning, the particle density is equal everywhere. So you make the control volume such that they have equal load in the beginning.
But can you partition it in runtime?
You can, but you have to program that yourself.
No, then so, you don't have this big deal with...
Yeah. So what we do is, for example, what we do with the load balancing is that we shift dynamically during runtime, let's say, for example, this yellow line here, okay? For example, we shift it to this direction. Yeah. If here is too much work and here is not so much work, then we shift this yellow line to this place maybe and have the equal number of particles here and in that part. But the problem is you have a complex, very often you have a complex three-dimensional structure in the control volume, let's say like the wing of an airplane, and you have 1,000 such small yellow lines because you have 1,000 processors working on this. And to shift these lines in a way that after shifting it's well balanced is complicated. But in fact, it's the way that people do this. But you have to program this manually. There's no automatism for that.
Можно в таком случае немножко изменять в процессе расчета эти границы, да? То есть, допустим, там, где много частиц, делать объем поменьше, там, где мало частиц, делать объем побольше. Но это требует искусства большого от программиста. И, в общем-то, эта задача такая, достаточно трудная, затрудняет. Может быть, для программирования она гораздо более трудная, чем написать просто программу.
Okay. The third example. This is also a popular example that we sometimes see even with numerical applications, although maybe this is more for non, but sometimes for numerical, sometimes for non-numerical. The thing is, this tree search here can be perfectly parallelized in general, even with the load balancing problem. And it works the following way. Let's assume, for example, the chess game. So we have one position on the board. This is the point where we currently are. And we have four possible moves that we can make from this position. So for the four possible moves, I mean, these are the arrows, for the four possible moves, you get four possible new positions. And with each new position, you see how many moves can I make from this position. For example, here it's three, here it's two, here it's two, here it's five. You see how many moves you can make from this particular position. You will end up in, again, some new positions. And you follow these principles as long as it needs to find a winning position. So that one here, where the word solution is written, is just a position on the chess game, on the chessboard, where you won the game, for example. For a theorem prover, for example, the solution point here might be a point where you can verify this theorem that you have to prove. So the parallelization here, let's first say the problems of this. The problem is that for some applications, the level of solution is unknown. I mean, you know, on the chessboard, you can move in different directions and you can just run around, so you don't know exactly how long this tree might get. There are other applications where it is limited. For example, what we did,
with such a tree search, and that is really nice for students. It's a good work because you can have a nice program on a parallel computer. We used it with the solitaire program. With a solitaire, you know, with this wooden thing where you jump with such a stick over the next one and take it away, and in the end you must stop in the middle. So in the beginning, all the holes are filled with small wooden sticks. In the middle, there's a hole that is empty. Then you make a move, you take one stick away, and in the end, you must end up with one stick in the middle position. So with this game, for example, if you do it like a tree search, that's a different situation, because you know exactly, I think there are something like 31 or 30, maybe 32 sticks on this board, and you know exactly that with each move that you make, you take one stick away, such that the depth of this tree is limited to 31, because at latest, after 31 moves, you don't have any sticks more for moving, so it's the end of the game, obviously. This is not the case for chess, this is also not the case for theory improving sometimes, and therefore we distinguish between trees that have a known depth and somewhere sometimes the depth is not known, and of course also we don't know where the solution lies. By the way, this computation with the solitaire, that was interesting for me because once when I was a student, I found a solution for the solitaire game and made some moves that were pretty symmetrical. So I made some moves here, the same one there, the same one there, the same one there, and ended up in the middle. And I saw a student who had a completely different solution, which was completely asymmetric, doing some moves here, some moves there and there, and ended in the middle. So I had the question, well, how many solutions do exist for this game? And then 10 years later or so, when the computers were strong enough, we programmed that and made some computation, and it's for 10 to the power of 16 different solutions that you have. But also it comes, of course, from symmetric, from effects of symmetry, because, I mean, the board is then can be turned like that, can be mirrored like that, and we counted all the solutions, okay? And the interesting question, by the way, was if it's 10 to the power of 16 solutions that are available, why do I usually need so long to find one single one? And the answer is that we also computed, I mean, for the tree, for example, what you can do, and for the solitaire, we succeeded. Nobody can do this for chess at the moment, but we don't know in 20 years maybe. For the solitaire, you succeed to calculate all the leaves of this tree. So what you can do is you count all the leaves of the tree and you see how many of the leaves are solutions and how many are not solutions. And you find that the relation between number of leaves that are not solutions, no solutions, and those who are solutions is about 1 to 10,000. So it's 10 to the power of 20 or so leaves and 10 to the power of 16 solutions. So as the relation is 1 to 10,000, I think that for a human brain there is a real chance to find one solution. If the ratio would be 1 to 1 million or so instead of 1 to 10,000, I think that the game would then be too complicated to find a solution with the human brain. But it's really nice and entertaining programming because it's an interesting parallel program that you can do. For chess, for example, you could very well imagine that this is not just a position during the chess game, but this is the starting position. So you would have, of course, many possibilities on the first level and then many more on the second level and so on. Well, but imagine now we have a computer, the biggest one has 200,000 processors. And with 200,000 processors, you can do quite some things. The blue gene approach of the machine is derived from this deep blue approach that IBM did with its chess playing computer. So they took principles that they learned with this deep blue computing and put that into this blue gene environment. Okay, so the level of solution is unknown. Then load balancing might be kind of a problem. For example, what we do here, and well, the last thing is detection of program completion, also kind of a problem, but not a big problem. So what we do here for the parallelization is the following, that a process computes the tree to a certain level,
and puts then the description into a waiting queue. And all the idle processors contact this process, receive an element, and compute the results. So that means, when we go back to the example, this part here, this top part, will be made by one process. This one process comes from a given position, computes following positions, and puts them into a queue and says, well, these are tasks that must be computed. And then, for example, this is done by process number one, and then process number two comes and says, well, I have no work to do at the moment. So it takes from the queue this position here and computes the remaining three. And this lasts, let's say, four time segments long. And then the next process comes, take this position, computes the rest of the tree, but this was quickly done. So it finishes quickly and takes another element from the queue and computes this one. And meanwhile, process number four, for example, took this job here, this task description, computed the remaining tree, but it lasted longer, but also it found a solution. So the distribution of the work can easily be programmed, load balancing can easily be programmed, because, for example, if this process here has too much work to do, then this process, who has no work anymore, could contact him and tell him, well, give me this position here, I will just compute the rest of the tree for that position. So it's very easy to dynamically redistribute work that was already distributed again to new processes. So very primitive, even beginners can write a program that is perfectly parallelized and where you get the maximum performance out of the machine. So just to finish this one here, then the idle processes contact the one that has the queue and get the new get some new tasks. This is a perfect parallel implementation. Load balance is no problem, because whenever one process has nothing to do, it just contacts another one and says to him, well, give me one of your positions, I will compute the rest of the tree. Completion detection is sometimes a little bit tricky, because if one of the processes finds a solution, it quickly has to inform all the other processes that they can now stop with the computation. And, I mean, that sounds easy, but imagine that you have, in the big machine, 220,000 processors, and you have on each processor one process, then you have 220,000 processes, and then the process 96,700-something finds a solution and has to tell to the other 220,000, hey, solution found, stop computing. It's not a problem to program that. It's just it will last some time. Yeah? And it will need some time to inform the other ones that the solution is now available and they can stop with the computation. And if you have this situation only one time in the end of the program, it's absolutely not a problem. So this completion detection just then takes some seconds or so. But when you have within theorem proving, for example, when you have the situation frequently, and because one process said, well, I will not be able to verify this theorem or the sub-theorem, let's do something else. And if you have this completion detection frequently inside one and the same application, then it gets a real problem, because it cannot be done 100% efficiently when you have many processors. Okay, the conclusion from the examples is as following. One conclusion is there are always different options how to do the parallelization. And if you do it this way or that way, will have a dramatic effect on the efficiency of the parallelization, on the efficiency that you will get out of the machine. The problem is that the German brain is not the human brain. Not the German brain. Yeah, perfect. Okay. The human brain. The human brain is not made in a way that you will be able to, just by looking on the source code, will be able to detect what the potential performance of the program is. For example, imagine this with the pipeline. If you look at just the source code of this thing, you will not be able to predict that it's, for example, not working perfectly in a pipeline way. Also, when you look at the source code of this wind tunnel simulation, you will not be able to predict whether it will be load balanced or not.
So only after you programmed it and after you tested it, you will find that it doesn't work perfectly, so the efficiency is not so as you would like to see it, and then you have to rearrange something. In many cases, we find that there's load imbalance, for example, and we have to integrate some code that somehow handles the load imbalance. And very often, I mean, what we really start with is, in most cases, data partitioning, because that is easier to program. It is more likely that you will get a good performance. If you are lucky, then you will even don't get load imbalance, and then after the parallelization, you will have a very good program already. And if you are really lucky, then we parallelize something like a tree search algorithm, because here, parallelization and integration of load balancing is one and the same thing. So just when you parallelize it, it's also load balanced in most cases, and you get a good performance out of it. I have another summary there, but this one at first.
Здесь что можно добавить? Что существуют разные алгоритмы распараллеления. Очень сильно все зависит от того, какая задача. И, конечно, лучше всего, конечно, распараллелить по данным. То есть, если у вас есть независимые данные, то желательно использовать этот путь. Ну и, в общем, по поиску оптимального дерева, да, оптимального перебора комбинаций, значит, здесь эти задачи могут тоже быть распараллелены довольно эффективно. Все? What is the game with, you talk about?
Solitaire. The name of the game is Solitaire. You know?
No.
Do you have, is this a whiteboard here?
Yeah.
It's just like this. Then you can stop. Ah, well, okay. So you have these positions like this. Three lines here. And then, and in the beginning you have wooden, the word is peg, so you have wooden pegs, which is small wooden sticks everywhere, except here in the middle, okay? And what you are allowed to do is that when you have a position like this with one peg here, one peg here, and a hole here, then you are allowed to jump over this one, and the final position will then look like this. And you can do this horizontally, these moves, and vertically. Okay, so in the beginning, for example, you have four possibilities for moving. One is from here to the middle, the other one from here to the middle, the one from here to the middle, and one. So if you parallelize it, you will of course not compute all four options. That makes no sense because they are symmetric by rotation. Instead, you will only compute one of them and compute the tree for one of these things and then just multiply the number of solutions by four. But it's only a side comment.
But you need an intensive internet process communication to handle this symmetry, to know that the situation was already handled, symmetric one. And you need to store them. And
we here in this case, let's say, if we do a primitive parallelization, we only consider the rotation symmetry on the with the first move, not on further positions. You can do this, but then, as you say, it gets much more complicated. Once I did this with a group of French students while I gave a lecture in France for half a year, and we took this as an exercise, and they developed all sorts of optimizations that you can do there.
And what's the goal of the game?
Well, the goal of the game is that, in the end, everything is empty instead of the middle. And as you get one stick away with each move, so these are 7, these are 21, and these are 6 and 6. 12, so it's 33 positions, it's 32 pegs that you have on the board. And with each move you get one peg away, which means after 31 moves the game is over, at latest. In most cases earlier.
Because then, I mean, one variation is to say, okay, it's also allowed that the final peg is somewhere here. So it's nice to compute because, for example, once we wrote a paper about that, you can do very nice considerations from the mathematical point of view. For example, you know that in the end, you have to end up here. So the question is, how can I end up in this position? The answer is, well, with a move either that way, this way, or that way, or that way. So you know that these things here, one of these must be available in order to be able to make the final jump to the middle. So as soon as, for example, you don't have any pegs on these positions anymore, you can stop with the game, because you know that you will not be able to finish the game. And the interesting fact is that sometimes if you analyze the tree, for example, you will see that there are situations where after having made 5-6 moves from the start position, you already did one decisive error, which leads to the fact that in no case you will be successful. But you don't see it because you can continue for quite a while. So that's why this thing is, from the mathematical point of view, it's very nice also to do. Once you can compute the whole tree, and now we can it with supercomputers, once you can compute the whole tree, it's very nice to do some mathematical analysis on it. And by the way, we computed the whole tree in 98 on a single machine, which at this time had about 700 megabytes of memory. It was the biggest machine that we could get access to. And then we were able to store the complete move table into a database of something like 30 megabytes. So what we were able to do is that you say, just give me a position on the board, and I will tell you how to continue to win the game. Or I will tell you this cannot be won anymore. So it's really nice what you can do there. But it's just for fun. But it's a nice parallelization.
Okay.
What was the question, Mr. Quality?
Yeah. Are there examples when parallelization decrease the computational efficiency?
The computational efficiency.
Efficiency.
The question was about exactness, I guess.
Accuracy, yeah.
Accuracy. This is a difficult point. In fact, yes, because maybe let's come back to this point tomorrow when we speak about the library, because there are special operations in the library which might have as a negative consequence just what you said. The negative consequence might be that the accuracy might be changed. So sometimes we see this, and I will explain tomorrow the position where this happens. Okay? So we shift that question to tomorrow.
Okay.
Sometimes that happens. That's really the case.
Okay. So we will have a lunch break.
One more
slide. Sorry.
That was just a summary for the examples. So there's the overall summary. Okay. What we have seen is that parallelization in general is complex. It's much more complex than the usual sequential programming. And of course, then you get more computational power, and the scientists somehow must balance the effort. I would say usually it's better to have a non-optimal parallel program, but nevertheless be able to run it on a supercomputer and get powerful results within short time. It makes no sense, just like computer scientists, to say, let's search for the optimal parallelization. Because when you run the program, when you make a production run, let's say for the wind tunnels, then the effort is okay, because they run this program for years. But when you as a scientist need the program, for example, within the framework of your PhD thesis, then you will run this program 10 times or 20 times. So it is not necessary that it's 100% perfectly parallelized. Most important is just that it's parallel and you get high performance out of the machine. We see that we do this with code and data partitioning, but in almost always the data partitioning is the way to go. As for tools, we basically use the program libraries, and this will be the topic of tomorrow, plus the own experience. So if you don't have own experience at the moment, then it's only the libraries. And that means, well, you have to gain the experience, and I can tell you this is difficult in the beginning. So I just in summer, I have a lecture for my students where they start with this, and it takes a while to get accustomed to that. In particular, also to recognize that even with very simple programs that do only a little bit of message passing, you can make very severe protocol errors with this message passing that either lead to deadlocks or to race conditions where you have just different results for each program run. And so the errors that will show up in the parallel program are tricky sometimes. We see that there's a difference between numerical and non-numerical programs. Tree search, for example, as non-numerical, just like this solitaire game, these are really nice things for parallelization. Parallelization usually is not so difficult, and most cases gives you perfect performance out of the computer. One thing that has to be considered is that usually if we look at the source code, we will not be able to predict how efficient it will run once that you have 220,000 processors, for example, 220,000 processes. Even if it's only 4 or 8, the human brain is not made to just overlook this concurrency that is going on the individual positions. So that's the reason why we make so many errors in the beginning when we start with this type of programming. Okay, so much for today.
Okay. Thank you. We will go to the lunch, and at 3 o'clock we will have a student's presentation. 15 minutes and 5 minutes for questions. We have at least, at the least, we have 8 докладчиков. Медведи уехала, да? Значит, 7. Ну, у нас вот как раз по 20 минут на докладчика. Я думаю, что мы где-то, ну, и сразу после этого мы перейдем на семинар. Хорошо.